This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium Patron Taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica Podcast on Patreon to support us and allows members to request future stories and themes. Thank you for listening. This podcast contains mature content and is intended for an adult audience only. It contains explicit words, thoughts, and ideas. The content of all stories is fiction with any similarities to real people or events being purely coincidental. This podcast is not intended for anything but entertainment of the listener, and if you do not agree with the themes listed in the tags, please do not listen to the story. All characters engaging in sexual relationships or activities are 18 years old or older. This story was found on a free website and brought to audio form here. I did not write and take no credit for this story. Please visit the link in the comments to further support this author. Dream Drive Part 8 by Overed. Chapter 09. It had been a good handful of hours since Jackson had gone with Shaka into the mountain. Chalky was sitting at the campfire outside her family's teepee. Landry sat with her. Pala was sleeping inside. The night was cold, so they brought out a blanket to cover themselves. It was sewn from the skins of two coyotes that Chalky's father had baited and killed, one a mix of tan and white, the other mostly brown. She rubbed the fur idly. It was soft. It reminded her of his warmth. She glanced up. Her father's war jacket hung from the top of their teepee. It looked streaked with black and red from the light of the fire. She didn't like the sight of it in the dark, and turned her eyes away. Her bond with Jackson pointed toward the mountain, but not long after he'd left, it had changed. She could barely feel him. It was as if she could see him in the distance, standing a mile away on the plains, but they were so far that even their loudest shouts could only be faintly heard. The little nuances of his soul, the steel walls, the heated core, the crumbling patches of rust, all of it was gone. "You should try to get some sleep," Landry said. Chalky shook her head. "He'll be fine. Shaka will protect him with her life." Chalky nodded. Landry embraced Chalky with an arm, bringing her close. "Jackson is strong. He'll be back in the morning, and I'll finally have you out of my tent." "Come," Landry said. "Perk up. I'm just—" Chalky reached for their bond. She felt nothing. Her eyes widened. She hunted desperately, reaching a mental hand into the place her essence sat. A sick feeling began to rise in her throat. And then it was there, a tiny, golden thread. She clutched it as if holding her essence, ready to draw a rune. She was afraid to let go.
"He's never been this far away before," Chalky said. "If something happens, then I won't be able to. He will speak with Shakan,"
Landry said.
"He will learn of his mission. He will return here. And that will be that."
"Yes."
That was what Chalky said, but she didn't think it would be so simple. If Jackson had to leave, would she leave with him? He already seemed to be thinking about that day, considering a future in which they would have to support one another in conflict, in violence, if need be. It was madness. Leap away with a warrior on an adventure, leave everything she'd ever known behind, friends, family, her life on the plains. What would her tribe do without their next spirit guide? Shaka was still strong, but she was aging. Would she have time to train another in Chalky's stead? A wind blew. Chalky pushed close to her mother. Landry used one hand to fix the blanket around them, shielding them from the cold air. The firelight flickered. She could hear the sound of hooves in the distance. The hooves rapidly grew closer. A heavy, rhythmic thud in the grass. Closer. Chalky and Landry exchanged a glance. A horse galloped into view from the darkness. In an instant, it blew past them, smashing straight through the campfire and sending coals flying. Chalky brought the blanket over their faces. She could feel the flecks of heat batter against them. They heard the horse give a pained and tired whinny. Wood snapped, crunched. Chalky threw the blanket off. Their tent was half collapsed, trampled by the horse. The animal reared up, eyes wide, wheezing big, slavering breaths. And then it took off again, running deeper into the camp.
"Pala!"
Landry shouted.
"Pala!"
"What? Who? What's—"
Chalky saw motion under the teepee's leather. Pala batted his way free and stuck his head out.
"What happened? Is it a storm?"
Landry sighed in relief.
"Thank goodness.
There was someone on that horse,"
Chalky said.
"I'm going after it."
She took off at a run. Strewn possessions and torn up tent stakes followed in the wake of the maddened beast. Other people were gathering, throwing open their tents to see about the commotion. When she caught up to the animal, it had crashed into yet another tent. Now it was bucking, kicking up its rear legs again and again. Chalky watched the animal carefully, trying to look for some way to get close, but it was too unpredictable. Its face was wild. It seemed unfocused. Was it in pain? Her eyes widened. There was a person tied to it, a small figure, swathed in black, strapped to the horse like a human saddle.
"Surround it!" shouted a voice. "If it tries to run again, use force."
Hanta was there, along with Vuntha and several of the other men. Yucatan was leading them. The elder's head was bald to the night, having rushed from his tent without his headdress. They circled the horse with their spears. The horse kept bucking, but it stayed in place, torn between dealing with what had it panicked and keeping away from the sharp spear points. The elder crept closer. The horse had stopped for a moment. Its great bulk stretched as it heaved air. As Yucatan reached for its reins, he had to lower his spear, and immediately the horse lashed out,
whipping its head at him. The elder was sent tumbling backward. Chalky and Vuntha grabbed him under the arms and quickly drew him away, setting him back on his feet. He brushed himself off and set his spear again. Hanta called from the other side of the horse.
Elder, are you all right?
I'm fine, he said.
Chalky, can you calm it? Like Shaka?
I will try. Chalky gripped her soul tight and began to draw runes. Simple pictures, one for slumber, one for calm, one for horse. Bright gold lines arranged themselves into pictograms in front of her. She walked forward, holding them out like a shield, and pushed her magic into the spell. The horse stopped bucking. Its eyes focused on Chalky, but its breathing was still labored.
It's all right, Chalky said. I am a friend. You're in a safe place now.
She slowly touched the flank of the horse. It whinnied, skipped with its feet slightly. She laid her head on its side.
Sure. It's okay. You will be fine.
The horse's breathing began to slow. She glanced at Yucatan and nodded. Yucatan held up three fingers. He and two others lowered their spears and approached.
There is a metal spur stabbed into its hind, Hanta said. I can see the blood.
Yucatan and the third man, Bunta, Chalky saw work to untie the person on the horse.
What is the meaning of this? He said. Why didn't they simply ride? Chalky, can you prepare it for pain?
Hanta said.
I want to withdraw the spur. I'm running out of essence, she said. Wait until they are away.
Yucatan and Bunta slung the unconscious rider off the horse and carried them out of their circle. Chalky drew an extra few runes. Her essence immediately started draining faster.
No,
she said. She ran her hand along the horse's mane and spoke softly.
Please tolerate this. It will hurt, just briefly.
Hanta's hands were quick. The horse jerked, whinnied. Chalky hugged its neck, whispering soothing words near its ear. Once Hanta was clear, she stopped her push into the spell. The horse's legs began to tremble. With the source of pain removed, it promptly laid down in the grass. Foam ringed its lips. It had been running for a long time. She released her runes, then drew new ones, expending the last dribble of her essence to seal the gash. It was just a patched scab, really, but better than leaving it totally open. The horse laid its head down in the grass and closed its eyes.
It's a woman!
Chalky gave the horse one last pat, then hurried to where they had set down the stranger. She was a tiny, thin girl. Streamers of yellow blonde hair played from her head and over the grass. Chalky kneeled next to her.
I know her. I know this girl.
Everyone looked at Chalky.
Explain, Yucatan said. She is an acquaintance of Jackson Vidalt.
Chalky remembered when he looked her up, back when they visited Earth.
Ray something, Rachel.
That was her name. She was the person he'd met in the Raddock Cave.
Which means,
Chalky peeled the black glove off the girl's left hand. Unlike Chalky's knee tattoo, her mark of Shakan was a twisted, spidery thing like Jackson's, melted into the flesh.
She came from the Iron Men,
Bunta said. His eyes were wide, his jaw was set tight.
She's wearing their clothing. She is a warrior of Shakan, like Jackson,
Chalky said.
Then she's just as dangerous,
Bunta said.
Jackson is our friend,
Bunta said.
My point exactly,
Bunta said.
We don't need any more friends like him, unbalanced fools that flaunt their powers.
Enough, Bunta, Yucatan said.
You've made more than enough trouble on that front.
Somewhat cowed, Bunta sat back on his heels and huffed.
Chalky, what's wrong with her? Why doesn't she wake?
Chalky inspected Rachel more closely. Her eyes were red, puffy, as if she'd been crying. Her eyelids were shifting. Chalky peeled one of them back. Rachel's eye twitched erratically, like someone in a deep dream, but it was too fast, too strong. She went to check her pulse. Chalky's fingertips were shocked with a harsh, stinging pain. She drew back, hissing. A wooden collar tucked under Rachel's clothes flashed with embedded runes. Rachel's body tensed, then fell slack.
This collar is embedded with magic,
Chalky said.
It struck at me when I grew close. Perhaps they were holding her prisoner with it. Why would they do that?
Vuntha said.
Collar a human, of all things. The Iron Men treat people like animals, when it suits them,
Chalky said.
I experienced it firsthand. And what if she was acting like a wild animal?
Bunta said.
They might have collared her for their own safety. I don't trust Shakan's power in the hands of outsiders. You sympathize with the Iron Men too much,
Chalky said.
No one should be treated like this, regardless of the reason why,
Yucatan said.
It was done. Chalky, what is the collar doing to her? I'm not sure,
Chalky said.
Keeping her like this, a feigned sleep?
That makes sense, Hanta said.
She couldn't remove the collar, so she tied herself to her horse and forced it to run. She knew it would put her to sleep when she tried to escape from her masters.
Which would indicate, Chalky said, looking at Bunta,
that she is no friend of theirs. Perhaps she was trying to reach Jackson. We can't trust her,
Bunta said. He moved to the center of their group.
Not until she explains herself, anyway. She is Jackson's friend,
Chalky said.
He spoke well of her. And sacred law dictates that all those not of the tribes that approach the mountain shall be killed,
Bunta said.
But I'm not advocating for her execution, am I? Then what are you advocating? This is a matter of Shakan,
Bunta said.
We must wait for Shaka and the other spirit guides to advise us.
Chalky stood and faced him.
I think I'm perfectly capable of, you're an apprentice,
Bunta said. He looked at his father. We should isolate her in a tent, and set a guard within it. When Shaka returns, she will know what to do. As it is my idea, I am happy to take the first watch.
Bunta lowered his head.
I believe I have a great deal of ground to recover in Shaka's eyes. Please allow me this, that I might begin in that regard.
Yucatan nodded.
Your suggestion is a good one.
What Bunta said wasn't unreasonable. They didn't really know Rachel. They didn't know if they could absolutely trust her. But it didn't sit right with Chalky. She saw a river snake maneuvering about for some sort of advantage. Yucatan only saw his son trying to make amends. Chalky looked at Hanta for help. Hanta caught her gaze, then duly cleared his throat.
Perhaps, as Bunta has strong feelings concerning the matter, I or another might make a better guard. Are you saying my son is unable to calmly watch a slumbering girl?
Yucatan asked.
I'm not commenting on his ability, Hanta said. Only his state of mind and spirit.
Bunta scowled.
My mind is sound, Hunter, and my spirit sounder still. Is that so?
Yucatan said.
It seems to me that my son is in an especially poor state of being, considering that talking back to his elders is exactly the kind of idiocy that he needs to correct. Starting now.
Bunta winced. Chalky watched as the deliberation wound its way across Yucatan's features. On one side was his son, and on the other side was his son. She did not like Yucatan much, but she respected him. She did not envy his position. Yucatan looked at Bunta.
I will trust you with this responsibility. You will guard the girl. You will not do anything further to sully yourself.
Bunta didn't hide a tight smile.
Yes, father. And perhaps for demonstrating that you possess more wisdom than Shaka currently believes, she will not skin you alive when she returns.
Bunta's expression faltered.
Yes, father. Set her in my spare tent, Yucatan said. Check through the camp, and make sure all were unharmed.
Chalky? Chalky's teeth were still grinding from Yucatan's pronouncement, but she managed a nod.
I will heal anyone who was hurt.
Thank you.
Hanta and Vanta, come with me. We need to gather the elders.
So late?
Vanta said.
This might wait until morning. Rested heads are better.
It can't wait,
Hanta said, starting after Yucatan.
That horse was dead tired from running, but it couldn't have come across the entire plain.
What does that mean?
Vanta asked.
It means,
Yucatan said,
that she was probably not alone.
Telad's throat worked, but no sound came out. He lay on the ground inside Hale's tent. His face was pushed into a pool of churned up grass and his own bile. He'd long since vomited up everything else. He was in a strange state of being. Hale had done something to his collar, forced his mind to stay aware when he normally would have blacked out. He'd gone so far into the pain that it had stopped hurting. It wasn't unlike running one's hands under scalding water for so long that the sensation simply faded. Even though the flesh started to poach like an egg, the nerves had made themselves hoarse, shouting at the arms to move, and their voices grew weaker and weaker.
How long?
Hale said, pacing back toward him.
Have you concealed this from me?
Telad really did the best he could, but the air wouldn't come out. The pain lessened slightly, which was bad, because that let Telad feel it again. His jaw clenched up. His teeth hurt from being ground together for so long. He'd gone back to his tent and tried to ride it out, but eventually one of his men had come looking for him and saw him twitching on the ground. And then Hale started wondering where Rachel was. Hale's face came into view. He knelt on the ground.
How long, Commander?
Hour,
Telad managed.
May too. 1 or 2 hours?
Hale said.
Your pain tolerance has really gone up over the years.
Hale stood again, then delivered a sharp kick to Telad's groin. Pain exploded between his legs, amplified by the effect of the collar. Telad could feel his thoughts scramble up. His vision warped and swam. The rest of his senses were drowned by the volume of pain. He only vaguely heard Hale's voice.
Captain Hammond!
Yes, sir.
Rouse the troops. We're attacking immediately.
How long to the mountain?
3 hours if we push, but the men will be tired. Give them a half-hour break after the first 2 hours.
Double rations for breakfast.
I don't want surprise ruined by exhaustion.
Yes, sir.
Footsteps. Telad felt his clothes shift. Hale had grabbed them. Their eyes met again, his against Hale's cold, hunting gaze.
If my plans for Rachel are upset by this one last little rebellion of yours,
Hale said,
I will make you beg to feel like you do now.
You won't deny me a second time, Cade.
Do you hear me?
Telad was flung back to the grass. He rolled once, limbs lifeless, eyes squeezed shut against the pain. For a moment, the name Hale shouted swam in his head.
He saw faces, he knew them as his family. There was a girl, a young woman. Delicate of frame, with shining blonde hair down to her waist. His sister.
An odd thought rose up from the pain like a piece of driftwood bobbing to the surface. Lady Ransfeld reminded him of his sister.
Jackson's statistics, strength 100 plus 10, plus 10%. Vitality 185 plus 19, plus 10%. Agility 50 plus 3, plus 5%. Compulsion 0 persuasion, 0 spirit 80 plus 20, plus 25%. Health, 248.00/248.00 essence, 120 plus 151 carry weight, 28.4 to 59.0.
Jackson ducked under the archway leading out from the portal room. His silvery rune cast a small orb of light around him. The sigil floated where he'd drawn it, moving relative to his position, like a little moon orbiting planet Jackson. The walls were black,
and the floor under his feet was black, and the ceiling was black. It felt like walking through space. He brushed his left hand on the wall. It felt cold, but smooth. His spear was in his right hand. The energy conversion cannon dangled from his belt, the strange gray gun with a claw-butted barrel. He had full health, plenty of essence on hand, and more essence stored into the gemstones in his pockets that Chalky had charged up for him. Chalky was more than happy to temporarily become his personal essence charging station. He couldn't use the light blue essence he acquired from her to increase his base stats, but it freed him up to use the dark blue essence he'd earned from slaying enemies to do just that while still keeping a reserve for his special attacks. He had put another 40 essence into spirit, hedging against bleeding out anything extra. Considering he was going somewhere serious, he also wanted the added benefit of extra magic resistance. That left him with 127 essence, so he added 7 to agility, nicely rounding it out at 50 points and his total dark essence at 120 points. He decided to keep 120 as a reserve. It was a lot to have on hand, but Jackson still hadn't felt much benefit from his base statistics. Vitality definitely helped him during the mountain games, but he was still exhausted relatively quickly, panting his lungs out as he ran from one place to another. Magic couldn't overturn a lifetime spent tinkering on desks with a few points here and there. His skills, both active and passive, had proved far more useful in terms of immediate survival. Still, he probably would have dumped all the essence he had into his attributes if it wasn't for the fact that charging his essence crystals had been extremely tiring on Chalky. The efficiency was low, so she had to push far more essence in than what he received in return. At one point, they'd felt something weaken in their bond, not as if it was fading away, but a flickering, like a flashlight turning on and off. Jackson urged her to rest, and the bond returned to normal after she'd sat down and had something to eat. Jackson hypothesized that a tiny bit of Chalky's magic was used to keep the bond active, and repeatedly dumping and gathering essence drained her past her ability to maintain it. The game's screens had been clear that a bond could only end with death, so it was probably just a transient condition. All the same, he didn't want to push it, or her, too far. Chalky wasn't one to complain. Despite looking more than a little haggard, she'd wanted to continue. He'd insisted she'd done enough until she gave up asking. If he was honest to himself, he felt a tad guilty. He hadn't intended things to go that far. Even if the bond was fine, she wasn't a machine. Cycling essence to herself over and over like that wasn't healthy. It was similar to what happened after Shakan took his need to sleep away from him. He went several days without resting, spending the entire night grinding up his skill levels. Even though he wasn't physically tired, and his mind was alert, he'd still felt used up and stressed out. There was something else aside from the body and mind that needed consideration. Shaka had claimed that the heart needed rest alongside the body and mind. Jackson didn't particularly care for that kind of foggy explanation, but he didn't have any other way to describe it. Given the circumstances, Chalky had more than fulfilled Jackson's expectations. He had his 120 dark essence and another 151 light essence, a formidable sum. He also had the essence crystal he'd claimed from the Radic Mage. He wasn't sure how much essence it contained, but since the smaller versions from the Radic Warriors held 50 each, it was a pretty safe bet that it was 100 essence or so. 371 essence. That was almost as much as everything he'd invested into his statistics so far. He was as prepared as he could be for whatever was down here. Jackson mentally corrected himself. He was in a place called the City of Demons. There was no prepared. Complacency would get him killed. The walls of the hall abruptly opened into a great cavern. He stopped there, peering ahead. A short shelf extended past the edge of the tunnel walls. He could barely see it, just a hint of a glimmer the reflected light of his rune. There was no railing. Past that, a drop into ink-black darkness. A single beam of light cut through that void, as though a spotlight was situated high on a wall in the distance. It burned through the dark and down past his perch. Here and there, he could see vague shapes, the points of more structures, but the light was swallowed up before it had a chance to illuminate anything. Jackson considered his runes. He could try putting actual essence into some sort of light spell, but he'd have to enchant something, either his clothes or his spear. Glowing pants that constantly used up essence didn't sound very appealing, and they probably wouldn't help all that much. It might also attract attention. He probably didn't want attention from whatever was in this place. It was quiet right now, but that could change very quickly. Jackson sighed, then looked about for a way down. The shelf turned into stairs that wrapped around the edge of a tower. The tunnel he'd just come through was actually an enclosed bridge, arcing from the portal room to the tower he was on now. Without anywhere else to go, Jackson started down. His moccasins were soft on the black stone. He kept a hand on the wall for balance, and to stay as far away from the edge as possible. He took the stairs one at a time. It was absolutely silent. Jackson could hear his ears ring a bit. He would have expected his movements to echo into the empty space, but the sound was engulfed and suppressed. The position of the distant ray of light gave him a sense of his progress. It was blocked from view as the stair curled around the outside of the tower, then appeared again as he stepped down in circles. Eventually, as his angle dropped, he could see the profile of another tower against it, and the bridge going off into the dark, and then, the roofs of other buildings, more towers, spires, and steeples. He wasn't sure how long it had been when his feet touched flat ground. He appeared to be in some sort of square. The black stone made a perfectly flat floor. There were no cracks, nor mortar. It seemed as though it was all one piece, black concrete poured into a giant mold all at once and allowed to set. He started forward. For a moment, he felt lost. The bubble of light from his room was weak to the point that he couldn't see more than a few feet. He used the distant beam to keep his bearings. After what might have been a few dozen yards, Jackson came to another wall. There was an opening ahead, with walls high to each side, like a spindly alley. He might actually feel a little bit at home if it wasn't for the oppressive darkness. The stuff sat on him, pushed at him. It didn't like him, and Jackson didn't much care for it either. He glanced at the light. He could still see the origin point, a tiny speck far above. The lower half of it was now blocked by walls and pointed roofs. He was definitely in some kind of city. No demons as of yet. The place felt dead in the way someone who had just died was dead. There was no smell, no real telltale sign, but the way the corpse lay, limbs slack, a bland glaze over the eyes, made it frighteningly clear. Jackson's spine shivered. The hairs on the back of his neck stood on end. He couldn't see a thing. Something could be right next to him, and he'd have no idea. His hands felt sweaty on his spear. He tightened his grip, then spun, swinging the tip into the darkness behind him. Nothing. No sound but his own breathing. He didn't feel safer. He felt worse. Jackson swallowed. He made sure his grip was firm, then gathered his voice. Is anyone there? The sound went a few feet and died. Jackson's lungs felt tired just from that effort. There was no energy allowed in this place. Anything that violated the stillness was pushed back. Jackson turned and jogged into the alley. He glanced up again. He didn't have any goals, any direction. He'd half expected Shakan to pipe up and say something. Maybe the light was indicating something important. The walls were tight on either side of him. He caught glimpses of a few openings, a few windows. He imagined eyes in all of them, watching him. He hoped he imagined them. The city was disorienting, maze-like. There didn't seem to be a pattern. He'd turn a corner only to immediately hit another intersection. He'd run along a path for a good while to find that it was a dead end. The first time it happened, he drew the energy cannon and turned on a dime, but there was nothing. There was always nothing. He kept the gun out. Maybe he could have gotten a sense of things if he could see it, but with the darkness, he couldn't even tell if he was where he'd been before. He tried scuffing the stone a few times, scratching it with his spear. No good. No marks, no chips. He stopped after a couple tries, afraid of breaking the point of his weapon. Progress was slow, but with a steady reference point, it was progress. The sense of being watched increased the closer he got to the light. He felt like a rat in a lab, stared at by creatures he couldn't comprehend that were observing his progress but not bothering to interfere. Yet. And then, he could see it, the point on which the light was shining. It was a beacon in the distance, the light at the end of his tunnel. He sprinted down the alleyway. He burst into an open space, another square. The light flooded over everything, washing out the black in favor of a dull gray. Jackson jogged to a stop and put his hands on his hips, catching his breath. He checked behind himself, looking at the alley leading back between two tall, featureless buildings. He almost felt silly. There hadn't been anything following him the entire time. He could have sworn something moved in the dark just then. He wiped his hand across his face and blinked a few times, but he couldn't see anything. He backed a few more steps into the pool of light he stood in, away from the edge. He'd come out of ruins infested with cannibalistic rat creatures not once, but twice. Even if there was a demon down here, he could handle it. He was a superhuman. After coaxing himself back into confidence, Jackson moved deeper into the light. The ground was carved with another mural, the same motif he'd seen in several places. The roots of the great tree hugged the center of the square, joined together to form the trunk, and then split into winding, curling branches that wove around the rest of the stone. An inverted pentagram was set into the middle of the trunk. Normally, there would be a claw at the base of the tree, nestled amongst the roots. Instead, there was a pedestal, sticking up from the center of the square, a claw-shaped pedestal. Artistic flair, I guess. As Jackson grew closer, he could see a small crystal hovering inside the cupped prongs of the claw. He leaned in to examine it. It reminded him of the gem flower. It was about the size of his fist. Was he supposed to take it? Jackson felt a wave of paranoia. He'd already encountered his share of ancient automated security systems. He looked around, taking in the empty black buildings at the edges of the square, and the murky depths of the streets, and crooked lanes leading between them. There were no other lights, no clues or hints. The city was empty. This was his destination. It was only then, looking into the darkness that masked the rest of the metropolis, that he realized finding his way back to the portal room would be completely impossible. He could wander out there for days. Fuck it. Jackson stowed his gun in a loop on his belt. He worked his fingers a bit, taking a few breaths and keeping on his toes. He grabbed the crystal and pulled. It didn't move. It felt very cold under his hand, almost like ice. Jackson frowned, then pulled again. The crystal was locked in place, held over the pedestal by some invisible force. He set his spear down and used both hands. It didn't budge an inch. Jackson sat on his haunches and sighed, rolling his spear in his fingers. He touched his essence and focused, as Shaka had taught him, but he couldn't sense anything. He stood, considering the crystal. It did look reminiscent of the gem flower, but it was a different color. That had been blue. It brimmed with energy. This crystal was colorless. It didn't feel like anything. So, maybe it needed energy? Jackson gripped his essence again. The power balled up inside his body rose to meet his will, ready for action. He put a hand on the crystal and pushed into it, as if filling up one of the gemstones he'd brought from the pawn shop. The crystal suckered onto him like a leech and drank from his spirit. Jackson tried to pull away, break off the connection, but his skin was sealed to the stone. His essence bar ticked down at a rapid rate. He set a foot against the pedestal and grabbed his wrist with his other hand, pulling back as hard as he could. The suction broke. Jackson toppled backward, his spear clattering down next to him. He sat up and checked his status. It drained him of exactly 100 essence, leaving him with 171. The crystal glowed and began to spin. Gray light sparked out from its sides like glowing embers flying from a grindstone. The crystal whirred faster and faster, until it was rotating so quickly it appeared to be spherical. Energy burned down through the claw pedestal in thin white lines. It spread over the square, under his feet, expanding in concentric circles. It rushed over the mural of the tree, washing it with white light. Symbols appeared around the mural and between the rings surrounding the claw. Jackson backed up, trying to take it all in. It was like watching a dusty bank of servers putter to life, lights blinking here and there, rusty cooling fans starting to beat at the air. He recognized many of the runes, but there were plenty he didn't. For a moment, Jackson wondered what would have happened if he didn't have 100 essence on hand. The more he thought about it, the more he decided he was better off not thinking about it that hard. One of the lights was a bit different than the others. Jackson turned his head, but the flickering light turned with him, staying in the corner of his vision. It wasn't part of the mural. The little indicator near his bars was blinking like crazy. The hunter. Jackson put his back to the pedestal and scanned the square. The alleys were still dark, quiet. His indicator flashed even faster, faster. It was getting closer. He turned about, trying to keep a bead on all the roads. He couldn't see anything. The indicator turned solid white. Jackson gripped his spear in both hands. He heard something above the whizzing rush of the crystal. He looked up. There was a black blur. A hand, a claw, swept in and punctured straight through Jackson's neck, cupping his skull. It pulled him across the square, dragging him along the stone. As they approached the outer edge, it released him, throwing him into the side of a building. Jackson struck the corner of the house. The air was knocked out of him. He hit the ground in a tangle, rolled over once, twice, and came to a stop. Jackson turned onto his hands and knees and fought for his breath, grunting and wheezing to get the feeling back into his chest. His spear was nearby. He snatched it back. His gun was gone, there, lying in the middle of the square between himself and the pedestal. Jackson rubbed his neck as he stood. He'd lost 66 health, more than enough to kill him in one shot if he hadn't upgraded his vitality. Then again, if he wasn't changed by Isis, that attack would have decapitated him. He heard the sound again, the flapping of wings. The creature, some combination of bat and gargoyle, alighted in the center of the square. It stood on two short legs that ended in talons. Its back was hunched sharply. Its wingspan was at least twice the size of its height. Too long, spindly arms stretched out from its torso, ending in blade-like claws that clicked on the ground. Its skin was a gnarled, sickly gray, and he could see black veins where it was stretched thin at the wings and joints. They stared at each other for a moment, either moving. Jackson ran for his gun. The hunter spread its wings and flapped once, propelling itself forward at high speed. As they both closed the gap, Jackson turned his head and screamed a war cry. A ripple of force left his mouth. The hunter swept out a claw. A pentagram appeared in front of it. The black shape expanded, twisted, and swallowed up Jackson's attack. Jackson barely had time to be surprised before they collided. The hunter clotheslined him with its outstretched arm. Jackson was sent reeling back across the stone. His health dropped by another 15 points. This time, he turned his fall into a roll, coming up with his spear ready. The hunter didn't press the attack. It had taken up its hunched position again, keeping itself between him and the crystal. The power in the square continued to glow and hum. It spread to some of the buildings at the edge. Jackson felt like the whole place was starting to light up. That couldn't have been just from his 100 essence. He was just the catalyst for something bigger, something the hunter didn't want him to finalize. Jackson went for the gun again. The hunter hopped into the air and sped toward him. Jackson changed direction, angling back toward the pedestal. The hunter flapped its wings rapidly, pulling up short, then coasted across the square to make it back before Jackson. Jackson turned again. Before the hunter could react, he had the gun in hand and was stepping backwards, keeping it aimed squarely at his foe. Sucker. Jackson compiled what he knew so far. This creature was far stronger than him. A direct confrontation was not a good strategy. It was fast, but it had trouble changing direction. It could cancel his special abilities. It definitely did not want him to get back to the crystal. It prioritized that above him retrieving the cannon. Jackson's finger hesitated on the trigger. The hunter was keeping to its defensive position, watching him with ugly eyes set in a skull-like face. It probably had some idea that he was holding a weapon, but it wasn't wheeling around trying to avoid his aim. The gun could use health or essence. But what if the hunter canceled the attack again? If it worked, Jackson would be in a bad way, but the hunter would probably be worse off. If the attack failed, he'd have sacrificed either all his essence or almost all his life force for nothing. And then he'd be easy pickings. It was a bad matchup, one Jackson had been afraid would show up eventually, something with an ability that could counter magic. It wasn't called a hunter for nothing. Jackson shoved the gun into his belt. He couldn't risk everything on a coin flip. If he died like that, Shaka would hunt him down in the afterlife and lecture him for all eternity. And then Chalky would get started on him. Jackson switched into his defensive stance. His hands glowed blue. He inched forward, closing the distance. The hunter bared its fangs and made a warning growl, a stuttering rumble in the back of its throat. Jackson tried to think about what the hunter had done to use its anti-magic. It had moved its arm. Drawing a sigil?
No.
But was the gesture important? He needed more details. Jackson looked up. He had 167 health left, 146 essence. His cheapest skill was Power Thrust, 5 essence for an extra strong attack. Time to abuse it. Jackson drew his feet together and walked forward, keeping his spear in close. The hunter spread its arms, flared its claws, and shrieked at him. Jackson leveled the tip of his weapon. The hunter flapped its wings, launching off its perch and sweeping toward him. Jackson's spear tip glowed white as he thrust it forward. The hunter saw the skill's glow. It swept its claw out again, moving its arm as if hurling the ability toward him. The black pentagram ate into the white light and vanished. Jackson knew that was coming. He was already drawing back for another thrust. The hunter whipped its other arm, canceling his magic with another pentagram, then flapped forward. Jackson threw himself to the ground. Claws raked across his back, draining a bit of health, but he was back on his feet in an instant. Jackson reached out a hand as the hunter peeled up and around to for another pass. He called out his new ability, Spear Wall. Gray light flared in front of the hunter's flight path. The spear-shaped bars of energy crossed over one another like the wall of a cage. The hunter swung wildly to avoid it. It clawed at Jackson as it flew by but missed by a wide margin. Jackson grinned. 116 essence left. That would be plenty. The hunter swung high above the square, then rounded back for another strike. As it flew toward him, Jackson cast his spear wall. The hunter threw a black pentagram, and the wall was eaten away, vanishing in time for the hunter to fly through. It flapped its wings faster. Jackson cast another spear wall, and then a third, almost precisely behind it, eating through another 40 essence. The hunter canceled the second wall with its other arm. Jackson had time to appreciate the panic in its eyes right before it smashed head-on into the one remaining. The bars shattered, and the hunter shrieked. It dropped like a stone, the ridge of one of its wings bent and cracked backward. It hit the square hard. Even with that impact, its talons were digging in, trying to stop its momentum. They found purchase in the lines of the mural. Jackson was already in a dead sprint for the pedestal. The hunter loped forward, using its arms, legs, and one good wing to move as fast as it could, faster than Jackson. They converged in the center of the square. The hunter was going to make it first. Jackson lifted his spear and dug it into one of the carved branches in the stone. Using that as leverage, he pushed himself forward, leaving his weapon behind and throwing himself into a full body lunge straight for the crystal. The hunter twisted sideways, bringing up its arm. Jackson stretched out his hand toward the crystal. They seemed to hang there for a moment, Jackson flying forward, the hunter whipping its claw through the air, trying to cut him off. Jackson squeezed his eyes shut. He expected a blow to the face, a hard landing on stone, but it never happened. He opened his eyes, then blinked several times. He couldn't see anything. He tried moving his arms and legs, and was greeted again by the odd sensation of floating. His stomach flopped uncomfortably. He swallowed back the sensation in the bottom of his throat. I'm getting sick of the teleporting. They'd been lucky. Rachel's horse had knocked over 3 tents, but the biggest casualty was a deep scratch on Canna's arm. Chalky used a bit of essence to heal her. Normally, she wouldn't waste it on such a small injury, but, thanks to the bond with Jackson, she could afford to be more generous. Pala had an aching back from where one of the tent stakes had struck him, but it wasn't anything a few minutes of stretching wouldn't fix. Their neighbors helped Chalky and Landry fix their teepee back to the ground, and soon enough, he was back inside and sleeping soundly. Landry joined him to take her own rest. Chalky knew she should try to get some sleep, but with Jackson and Shaka inside the mountain, sleep had never been more distant. She remained outside, meditating near the fire. She watched the flames, held her essence, and breathed. The smoke smelled good. Out on the plains, they had to burn whatever they could find, but the Three Hills tribe had brought entire sledges filled with sweet-burning red pine. Her essence bar filled at an incredible rate. She could feel the change as well, that familiar sensation of returning potential, energy condensed and swirling inside of her. What used to take her days now only required a few minutes of focus. With her magic restored, Chalky climbed to her feet and turned away from the fire, looking down the path toward the center of camp. The elders were probably already meeting about Rachel's sudden and chaotic arrival. And now, Bunta was alone with her in a tent. Chalky didn't like it. She needed an excuse to visit. She grabbed a bison heart pouch from where it hung on the side of their tent and made for the river. She filled the pouch with water, then walked back through the camp with a quick stride. Making sure Rachel wouldn't be dehydrated in her unconscious state seemed like a pretty good reason to intrude. The tent erected near the elders' large teepee was small, something a newly married couple would use having just left their respective families. At the moment, Yucatan was using it to store his spare wealth. What he didn't hold in horses within the herd was kept in the form of bison skins and wolf pelts. Chalky called out, and pushed the entrance flap aside at the same time. Bunta, I'm bringing water for Ratch. She stopped, the pouch held in both hands in front of her. Her eyes widened. Rachel was lying face up on a blanket, still in her enchanted slumber. Bunta was kneeling next to her, one arm tucked behind his back. Sweat rolled off his face. Chalky could see rips and tears in Rachel's black leather, exposing the pale skin beneath. Bunta's lips moved up and down. He swallowed, looked at Rachel, then up at Chalky. What is it? What are you doing here? She hasn't moved. Bunta, Chalky said. What are you holding? I'm not holding anything, he said. Why do you say that? He brought his hand forward and turned both his palms up. Chalky threw the pouch at him. Bunta flinched, then grabbed for the container before it hit his face. Chalky darted around the side of the tent. There was a knife lying on the ground behind him. Chalky's mouth dropped open.
By the one above. You were trying to kill her.
That's not.
The pouch dropped through Bunta's fingers and rolled across the ground.
I can explain this.
It's not what you, then you were trying to have your way with her.
Chalky shouted.
A defenseless girl?
It wasn't I.
Bunta's eyes were wild. His tongue stuttered over itself. Chalky marched forward.
I knew it.
You rat.
You disgusting snake.
Bunta grabbed the knife and lunged for Chalky, tackling her at the waist. Chalky tried to scream, but the air was knocked from her lungs. It turned into a high-pitched grunt. Bunta raised the dagger and jammed it down into her chest.
I tried to stop her.
He shouted. He ripped the knife free, then stabbed Chalky again and again. He mashed his other hand over Chalky's mouth, stopping her from calling for help.
The coward woman woke up and attacked you.
Killed you.
I told them not to trust her. I knew she.
Bunta's hand froze in the air. He looked at where he punctured Chalky's hide dress with his knife.
You're like him.
He grabbed her wrist and twisted it, bending her hand to look at Shikan's symbol.
You're like them. You're one of them.
Bunta dropped the knife and put his hands around Chalky's throat. He was crying, now sniveling. Chalky grabbed his wrists, pulling at his hands, but he was far stronger. She had only been dazed from his tackle, but the choking was far worse, worse even than the sensation of a knife sinking into her stomach. Her health, having gone down in heavy chunks, now began to tick downward. Chalky tried to call out, to say anything, but it came out as choked gasps, and then she was out of air. It felt like her throat was being crushed. She flung her hands up into his face. She dug a nail into his nose and pulled it up. Bunta made a pained noise and twisted his head away, shaking her where she lay on the ground.
I loved you, he said. I love you. Why did you pick him? You bitch.
He slammed her head into the dirt.
You fucking bitch. I should have had you. You could have had me.
He slammed her again.
I hate that I still love you. I hate it. I hate you.
Chalky shifted her hips, trying to throw him off, but he was a lead weight made out of muscle. She kicked and scrabbled her feet on the dirt, but she couldn't get purchase.
This is all his fault,
Bunta said. He kept his head back, out of her reach.
Jackson Vidalt. I'll kill him. When he comes back, I'll kill him. Jackson Vidalt.
There was a scream, a hard, throat-ripping scream that tore into the air. Chalky thought it was her own voice for a moment, but she could still feel the pressure stopping her from taking a breath. Bunta looked back over his shoulder, his hands around Chalky's neck loosening. Rachel was awake. She was rolling on the ground, clawing at her neck. She screamed as if her entire body was on fire, over and over without pause.
Shut up! Bunta shouted. Shut up, you fucking!
Bunta's words cut off in a mangled cry as Chalky leaned up and dug her fingers into his face as hard as she could, digging into whatever she found with her nails. She found something soft, and Bunta shoved her away. She rolled across the ground, coughing and desperately filling her lungs with air. Bunta stood back up, a hand on his face. He hesitated for a moment, then went for the teepee's flap. Chalky grabbed him by the ankle, and he tripped forward, hitting the dirt on his stomach. She climbed over him, then slammed the heel of her palm into his head, pushing his jaw into the dirt. She got to a knee on his back, lifted it, and slammed it down. Rachel's screams pealed over them. Bunta grunted, and then he rolled, pushing her off. They both got back up and rushed for the entrance. Whoever made it out first would tell the story. Hanta shoved in under the flap.
What in the name of the sunburned demons is?
Bunta and Chalky slammed into him at the same time. Their collision took the entrance flap off its pinnings. They fell into a kicking pile of limbs and cloth. Chalky used her elbows to pry herself free, getting her head out of the mess.
Hanta, Bunta.
Bunta's hand caught Chalky in the side of the face. She nearly bit her tongue off.
Hanta, Bunta said. The girl woke up and started to attack us. She tried to choke Chalky. What is going on here?
Chalky felt herself being lifted up. Hanta brushed off her shoulders. Yucatan was standing next to him, still without his headdress, his eyes reddened and tired by a long night.
Chalky, is that screaming the girl? What is this?
Bunta shouldered his way in front of her.
Father, the girl almost killed Chalky. She got my knife away from me when I wasn't looking. Things were almost, that's not true,
Chalky said.
Bunta tried to kill her, and me. What?
Bunta asked, aghast.
What are you talking about? I just saved your life.
When she saw Bunta's face, his expression, and heard those words, the bold-faced lies of a man that tried to force his way with her, something inside Chalky snapped. She rushed at Bunta, leading with her fist. She caught him off guard and socked him straight in the eye. Bunta reeled backward. Chalky fell on top of him.
You damn, disgraceful, Shikan cursed liar! You tried to kill me!
Bunta covered his face with his hands as she rained down her blows.
You piece of shit, you slime off a worm's ass, you angel-damned horse-fucking little shit-headed bastard!
Chalky was pulled backward. She fought against the arms that were on her, kicking, scraping to get back and beat Bunta into the dirt until his mouth was so disfigured he couldn't speak ever again.
Chalky, calm down!
Bunta's voice, shouting in her ear.
Calm yourself! Chalky!
Chalky realized she was digging her nails into Bunta's arms. She released him.
Vanta steered her back a few steps, then gingerly let her be. Her breathing came ragged though her throat, part from the lingering soreness, part from the sheer rage that was keeping every part of her as tense as a bowstring.
What has gotten into you too?
Yucatan shouted. His gaze swiveled between where Bunta was picking himself up, wiping the blood from his nose, and where Chaki stood.
I can't turn my back without the two of you arguing and fighting.
Yes, your relationship ended poorly.
It ends poorly for many in the tribe. Act your age.
Elder Yucatan. A new voice, deep and ponderous, joined what was quickly becoming a large gathering. It was Kunaya, the elder of the Three Hills. His hard face observed the scene from within the recesses of his headdress. Despite the hour, he'd apparently taken the time to strap the 100 feathers around his head for the meeting.
What is the meaning of this? What is that screaming?
As he said the words, Rachel's screams cut off. Everyone exchanged glances. Hanta ducked into the tent.
It's fine, he said. She's asleep again.
He reemerged.
Chaki, what happened in there? I would rather,
Kunaya said,
hear an opinion from someone who is of calm mind and sound judgment. He lied to his father's face,
Chaki shouted.
My elder's face. I didn't lie,
Bunta said.
I can't believe you're doing this. Even when I take blows for you, you do everything you can to destroy my honor. I don't give a damn if Jackson isn't who you thought he'd be. You can't have me back.
Chaki growled and took a step forward. Vanta grabbed her shoulder.
Chaki, get a grip.
Chaki pushed Vanta's arm away, but she stayed where she was. She met Bunta's stare.
I'm not going to stand here and let you feed them horse shit.
To reiterate, Kunaya said.
I'd rather hear an opinion from someone who isn't acting like a crazed wildcat.
The insult made it through Chaki's anger. She glanced about. Everyone was staring at her. As she took in the gazes, she realized what it must have looked like. Her barreling out of the tent, then attacking Bunta, who didn't fight back, and then her screaming her head off at him. She bit down on her words and took a step back, deferring to Kunaya without a response. She couldn't talk back to the most powerful man under the mountain and expect to have her words heard.
Bunta, Kunaya said. I know you as impulsive and proud. But in your impulsiveness, you are honest.
Chaki clenched her hands so hard her knuckles turned white.
What happened?
Everyone turned to look at him. Bunta cleared his throat.
I was sitting in the tent, watching the girl. Chaki came with a pouch of water, saying we couldn't have her dying of thirst before the elders returned.
Bunta gave a grudging shrug.
I thought that was a good idea. I didn't know how long the girl had gone without water. And then?
Kunaya prompted.
We got into an argument,
Bunta said.
She claimed she wished to dissolve her promise of marriage with Tatanka Ska, and take up with me again. Apparently he wasn't up to her expectations. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard,
Bunta said.
Chaki would throw herself off the mountain first. Is this how the Windseekers work out their problems?
Kunaya said.
Interruptions, flinging vile words at one another like mud? Honestly, Yucatan, get these children either under control or out of my presence. I was not in the mood to be roused to talk about some vagabond girl tied to a horse, and I'm not in the mood for this petulance. And neither am I,
Yucatan said, his gaze fixed on Vanta, and then on Chaki.
You will have a chance to speak after.
Be
silent.
Vanta swallowed and looked at his feet. Chaki just kept staring at Bunta.
Get to the point,
Kunaya said.
In short, I didn't agree to take up with her again,
Bunta said.
I tried to warn her about him from the start, but she made her choice, and a relationship isn't something to be turned on and off at her whim.
Things became heated.
I think the girl woke up and slipped my knife from my belt while we spoke, and stabbed Chaki. I managed to get her off and take the knife back, and then something happened with her collar.
The girl started screaming, rolling on the floor, and she dropped the knife. Bunta gingerly touched his broken nose.
Chaki wasn't finished with me, even after I stopped her throat from being cut.
Chaki was stabbed, Yucatan said.
Why is she standing?
She's like Tatanka Ska, Bunta said.
The knife didn't harm her. But she was still lucky. A warrior marked by Shakan probably knows ways around their magic.
All right, Kunaya said. He glanced at Chaki. His eyes were not pitying.
And your story?
I came in with water, Chaki said.
And I found him, kneeling over her, stabbing the girl with his knife.
Bunta raised his palms. His voice was incredulous.
Why would I kill the girl I just said we shouldn't kill? That we should wait for Shaka, that I'd help guard her? That doesn't make any sense. Does she have injuries?
Kunaya asked.
She's also like Jackson,
Chaki said.
A warrior of Shakan.
Kunaya nodded.
Then there's no evidence of a stabbing?
No, Chaki said. There are tears in her clothing, where the knife was used to cut.
There are tears,
Bunta said quickly. But they were already there, from her being tied to a saddle.
Her clothing was ripped before she got here. They were probably made worse when I fought her off. Is that true?
Kunaya asked Yucatan. The elder frowned.
I took her from the horse. But I don't remember either way. It was dark, and I wasn't looking for it. I helped you untie her, remember?
Bunta asked.
I saw it clearly enough. And I was sitting in the tent for 20 minutes before now. That's rather convenient for you, isn't it?
Chaki said.
Chaki,
Yucatan said.
Do not. I was there too,
Bunta said.
There weren't any rips in her clothing. Bunta made that up.
Jackson Vidalt's best friend in the tribes, Kunaya said.
defending his woman while he is away. Is there anyone in this story that is unbiased? Anyone at all?
Look at this, Chucky said. She drew her dress out slightly.
Look at the slashes. Bunta stabbed me. I would have died, if not for this.
Chucky raised her hand, showing Shikan's star mark.
This is ridiculous, Bunta said. That's from where she stabbed you.
It's from where you stabbed me, before you gave up on that and tried to choke me to death, Chucky shouted.
And her clothes didn't rip in the saddle. There will be cuts, like that from a knife, not frayed rips.
I was fighting her off, Bunta shouted back.
Of course I cut at her when I got my knife back.
You tried to murder her.
Why in the name of all the angels and the one above?
Bunta said.
Would I try to kill the girl I volunteered to guard? I don't give a damn about her. I'd just as soon she never came here.
You hate Jackson Vidalt, Chucky said.
You hated him as soon as you saw him, because you think he took me from you. And you thought that if you could kill her, you could kill him.
Unbelievable, Bunta said. Your lies twist faster than a wind spirit's cyclone. Chucky was about to shoot right back, but Kanaya cut her off.
It seems, the elder said, that given our alternative testimonies, this becomes a case of competing motivations. On one hand, we have Bunta, who, as I have so recently heard from his father, showed restraint in requesting that we wait for the spirit guides before passing judgment, even though the girl is a stranger in sight of the mountain. He looked at Chucky. On the other hand, a young woman who is clearly in the thick of her emotions.
Elder Kanaya, Chucky said, trying to control the tone of her voice. I have only respect for you, and so I will not lie. My emotions are not fully under control. But if you think Bunta is some great paragon of wisdom and self-restraint, then you should better exercise recent memory.
A very uncomfortable silence fell over the crowd. Everyone remembered Bunta's tantrum after his fight with Vanta, and how he'd shoved Chaka away, but no one had spoken of it. Chucky felt as though ropes of social decorum were stretching her limbs in different directions. She'd insulted the elder's son in front of the elder in public. Worse still, she'd done it in front of another tribe's elder, and not just any elder, but the leader of the largest tribe of the Three Hills, and by extension, the entirety of the plains. And she'd laid down a not-so-subtle criticism of the very same observation skills. To her own amazement, she found that she didn't care. She felt an exhilarating rush at telling this man, with his overstuffed headdress, pretentiously butting into their tribe's personal matters, exactly what she was thinking. I wonder if this is how Jackson feels all the time. Kanaya stared at her, sizing her up. Chucky stood without shame and stared back, waiting for his words.
Elder, Kanaya said. It is your tribe, not mine. What is your judgment?
Yucatan put a hand on the bridge of his nose and sighed. He rubbed his palm over his face.
Why do you two do this to me? Perhaps I might make a suggestion, so that we can all get back to sleep, Kanaya said.
Please do.
Separate them until their heads have cooled, Kanaya said. When all has had time to settle, perhaps we can be honest with one another, and agree to put this behind us. Riotous emotions can make bad ideas seem like good ones.
Chucky felt everyone give her a glance after his last sentence. Kanaya was building the situation against her, labeling her as the unstable girl that would act out if she didn't get her way.
You said we needed a scouting party, Kanaya added. Let Bunta take this new task. Let his thoughts air themselves outside of camp for a time. That aside, it's important that we deal with this issue quickly, but we shouldn't overreact. Even the largest trading caravans rarely have more than a few dozen people. They're likely stopped for the night. Bunta's party should be small, so that they may move without detection. We ascertain their location and their numbers for now, and we may better decide how to move upon them in the morning.
We're all tired now, Kanaya said.
Use the night to gather information, and when the sun's light shines, I think we'll all see a little bit clearer. If you have some of your scout to the east, I'll have mine go south and west. The dust gatherers can take the north side of the mountain.
Heads were nodding. It was the second time in one night that dozens of people had been roused from their tents by a violent disturbance, added to everyone's weariness from the celebrations and the feast. Kanaya's words were resonating.
Wise words, elder, Yucatan said. Bunta, you will take Vanta and catch Ran. Ride into the plains and scout for 5 miles east. Wake me when you return if you find anything.
Yes, father, Bunta said. Though, he wiped a bit of blood from under his nose.
I am not in the best condition at the moment.
Chucky, Yucatan said.
If you would heal him.
A dozen responses burst into Chucky's head at the thought of healing the nose she'd just broken.
I'd rather eat slugs.
I'd rather burn under the sun. I'd rather become the consort of a demon. I'd rather dance naked in front of the spirit guides from every tribe. Instead of speaking, in what Chucky believed was perhaps the greatest display of personal willpower she'd ever mustered in her entire life, she drew the runes and flung her will toward Bunta. It was a simple task. His nose cracked once, then shifted back into place.
Thank you, Chucky, Yucatan said.
Chucky's words were as stiff and formal as she could make them.
By your will, elder.
Bunta, Kanaya said.
A word for a moment.
He gestured out through the crowd, and led Bunta a short distance away. Yucatan looked over all of them.
The rest of you sleep. And if there is anything more like this tonight, I'll feed you to Shaka.
Everyone took off in a hurry at that pronouncement. Yucatan sighed heavily, then looked at Chucky.
Girl. What in the name of Mother Earth is going on between yourself and my son?
Elder, Chucky said. She drew herself up, trying to put as much of the mature spirit guide into her voice as possible.
I swear to you, by all the spirits, and the angels, and by the one above. She raised her mark. I swear by Shakan, and on my oaths as a woman who seeks to guide the spirits of our tribe, I have not lied to you this night. Your son has lost his mind, and I fear for his soul as much worth as it has left.
Yucatan looked at the back of her hand, and then back at her. She could see it turning behind his eyes, his hesitance, decisions torn between what he wanted to see and what he was afraid was true.
Did Shaka tell you what he almost did to me?
Chaki asked.
Yucatan said nothing.
Chaki moved closer to him.
She told you.
You did nothing then, and I did not speak of it further, because you are my elder, the elder my father chose. But if you continue to do nothing, then nothing good will come of it.
If Jackson wasn't there to save me that night, Bunta would have. Go!
Yucatan shouted. Chaki leaned away, blinking. Yucatan took a long breath.
Go to sleep, Chaki. I will consider this further in the morning.
Hanta, you watch the girl. Chaki watched Yucatan retreat into the night. She willed him to turn around, to change his mind, but he didn't. She turned to Bunta and Hanta.
Do you believe me?
I don't want to believe it,
Bunta said.
Because apparently I'm going out scouting with a madman in a few minutes. Hanta squinted.
There are bad spirits out this night.
Once Shaka returns, the truth of this will find its way free.
He hesitated, looking back at Chaki.
She could see the question on his face. The only people that knew about Bunta's actions were Yucatan, Shaka, Jackson, and Bunta, but she was sure that Hanta was taking a rather good guess as to what she'd meant.
Chaki, he said. You should probably get some sleep.
Bunta lingered with his father. Chaki walked alone through the camp. She ran through the events in her mind's eyes, over and over, and with each repetition she experienced the same boiling anger and confusion.
Why couldn't they just see it?
Why couldn't Yucatan just admit what Bunta was and be done with it?
Please hurry back, Jackson.
Shaka. Kunaya all but dragged Bunta by the collar once they were out of sight. He pushed them through the tents, leading them to one of the muddy roads that had been churned up by hundreds of footsteps between the encampments. This late at night, it was empty. They were distant from the closest teepees to either side of them.
You test my patience, boy. The girl was with that man, Bunta said.
Tell something.
Commander Talad.
Exactly, Bunta said.
She saw my face. I had to make sure she didn't wake up.
Chaki said she was Jackson Vidal's friend. She would have told them about the enough, Kunaya said.
I realize your position. But she was already unconscious. Even if she wakes, that collar keeps her unable to speak.
Even if you managed to kill her, what would you have done with the body?
Carried it out through the middle of the camp?
Covered it with a cloth and hoped no one came to check on you?
Bunta licked his lips.
His eyes hunted for answers in the mud at his feet.
You should have consulted with me before taking such a risk,
Kunaya said.
Understand that I have extricated you from your own foolishness for the last time.
Yes, Elder. I've managed to maneuver you into a key position.
The Elder stepped up to Bunta and clasped his shoulder.
He leaned in close.
You will be alone with Vunta and Katran while scouting. Lord Hale's armies are almost upon us. You know what must be done.
Yes, Elder.
Good.
Go do it.
Kunaya slapped his shoulder again. My own tribe is readying itself as we speak. Once it starts, ride around the edge of the conflict and find us. We will head southwest, then circle around to the other side of the mountain.
The Elder turned and walked off. The green stone in Bunta's pocket felt heavy. He dragged in a long breath of cold night air. This was it. This was the moment. He rubbed his hands together and glanced around. He felt watched. He scanned the dark places between the tents on either side of the foot-churn path. There was nothing. Just the wind and the dark. He went to fetch his horse. Katran gave a great yawn. He took a swig of water, then settled back on his horse.
Vigilance, Bunta muttered.
Shut up, Pebble.
I don't like you either, Bunta said. Let's just do this and go home.
Katran snorted, shrugged, and flipped his reins a bit. They rode close together, their horses plodding across the grass. Bunta led slightly, Katran was behind and to the left. Bunta was further back on the right, completing a rough triangle. The plains were dark. The stars weren't out, the sky was cloudy. A wind was driving the weather in from further west. It felt cold, a winter gust, heralding the end of autumn. Bunta drew his fur cowl tight around his neck.
I thought, he said, you might have changed your attitude after fighting with Jackson.
Tatanka Ska is strong, Katran said.
I respect him. But I don't recall you two getting married, so until then, you'll have to earn your own honor, Pebble.
I did beat Bunta.
You tricked him.
I used his assumptions against him.
Katran made a considering huff.
How calculating of you.
You sound more like Tatanka Ska every day.
I think he's having a bad influence on me, Bunta said.
At least you have a sense of humor, Katran said.
Nothing worse than a dry pebble.
My name is Bunta.
Oh yes, how terrible of me to forget.
Has it been 5 miles yet?
A bit further, Bunta said.
Unfortunately. It'll be sun up by the time we make it back,
Katran said.
I'm going to be tired on the day of my wedding. I already asked Malachi to move it back, but she refused.
Why? Bunta asked.
Chaki and Tatanka Ska are to be married tomorrow,
Katran said.
She doesn't want our pairing to be an afterthought to theirs.
He heaved a sigh.
Women. They'll sacrifice anything for the sake of appearance.
Enough already, Bunta muttered.
Your complaints make me sick. The fiercest warrior of the Windseekers speaks.
Catran said. He raised his head to the night.
Beware, spirits! The mighty Bunta shall brook no complaints.
Shut up. Are you jealous that you're the only one not getting married? Perhaps you'll be single forever.
Shut up, Catran!
Bunta shouted.
Keep your voice down.
Bunta said.
Did you forget we're scouting? But doesn't that sound like a romantic legend?
Catran said.
A warrior alone, against the cold and the bison, I forgot. Bunta doesn't have to hunt. His father is the elder.
Catran. Bunta said.
That is enough. Don't instruct me in anything, Pebble.
Catran said.
You'd be nothing if Tatanka Ska didn't rescue your dignity from the mud. Why he bothers, I do not know. Perhaps because he knows about something called honor.
Bunta hissed.
And loyalty.
Loyalty? Bunta said.
What makes you think Catran knows about that? He only cares about a good fight. Like a rabid dog. And you only care to use me as your tool for your pathetic little vendetta against your betters.
Catran said.
Did you think me your friend, Bunta? I knew you'd get me my battle against Tatanka Ska, and you did. The tribes will never forget the day I withstood a warrior with the blessing of Shakan for hours with naught but the strength of my limb and will.
You know nothing of strength. Bunta said.
Who was it that lost in the first round to a pebble?
Catran said.
He started laughing again. Who pushed aside his own spirit guide because he could not bear the weight of his own weakness. Oh yes, I remember his name. It was the elder son, Boondash.
A sharp grunt cut off Catran's words. Bunta glanced over his shoulder, about to shout Catran down before he gave them away to the dark with his mocking bravado. Catran had a knife sticking out of his side. Catran slowly looked down at the wound. His head turned in confusion at the wet patch of blood staining his jacket. He slumped off his horse and tumbled to the grass. Bunta jammed his heels into his horse and charged at Bunta out of the darkness, leading with his spear. Bunta threw himself from his mount, rolling across the ground and back up to his feet. Bunta's spear struck Bunta's horse, stabbing it in the neck. Bunta wrenched his weapon free as the animal screamed and went wild, scampering into the night. Bunta wheeled his horse and faced Bunta.
And now there is no ring, and no rules to stop me.
Bunta! Bunta said. He gripped his spear tighter.
What is the meaning of this?
The meaning? Bunta's face distorted into a sick expression.
You and your demon fucked honor. Your whole family is a pathetic group of showboating warriors. Your father is just waiting for mine to die so he can take over the tribe. Second-guessing his every decision.
Bunta grappled with Bunta's words.
That isn't true. You know that isn't true. When I'm finished with you.
Bunta said.
You'll be dead, and everyone else will be my peasants, and they'll slave for me for the rest of their lives. And it won't be this half-rule my father is satisfied with, running around like an exhausted parent trying to shepherd idiots. Real rule. Real power. And anyone that insults my name, I'll have them bound and sold as slaves.
Slave? Bunta shook his head, confused, and then it hit him. His eyes widened.
You sold us out to the Iron Men. That's how they captured Shaka and Chaki in the first place. They're out there, aren't they? You were trying to kill Jackson's friend before she could tell us. You betrayed us to those honorless rats.
I betrayed you? Bunta said.
I betrayed you? Chaki threw everything she had with me away after a few days walking alongside some white-skinned freak of nature. And you think I don't know what you and the others say about me?
Lazy Bunta, the elder son, relaxing in the shade of Yucatan. And Malachi, she passed me up for Catran, and now even Catran himself mocks me.
You heard him. Showing respect for that earth-cursed mongrel that did nothing except luck into his powers and stumble his way across the plains.
You're the ones who betrayed me. All of you.
Bunta kicked his horse into a gallop, leveling his spear at Bunta. Bunta had seconds until he would be impaled or run down. He couldn't fight a man on horseback alone and exposed on the plains. But his toes had been searching while Bunta had been ranting. He bent down and came up with a new weapon. Bunta chucked the rock at Bunta's horse as hard as he could. It struck the animal in the nose, skipping across its face. The horse promptly pulled up, tossing its head and turning away sharply. Bunta fought against it, trying to bring the animal back under control. Bunta ran up and jammed his spear into the horse's flank. He lodged it between the ribs and twisted. The horse made a screaming, high-pitched whinny and bucked hard. Bunta was thrown clear off his mount and fell to the grass.
Bunta winced as he pulled his spear free, hoping the injury wouldn't be fatal to the creature, but he hadn't had the luxury of being picky with his target.
The horse ran off into the dark, as confused and pained as the first, still bleeding from its side.
Bunta rose off the ground with his spear. He gave his head a hard shake, then stalked forward. Death was in his eyes.
Bunta focused on his breathing and set himself defensively.
Tiring Bunta out had worked before. It could work again.
Bunta lunged, extending his spear with a one-handed thrust.
Bunta slapped it to the side, backing away at the same time.
Bunta kept thrusting, and Bunta gave up his ground.
Bunta chased after Bunta with a flurry of thrusts, determined to skewer him.
Bunta stepped away from what he could and blocked what he couldn't dodge.
There was no rush, he had an entire plane to work with.
Focus. Don't get caught. Let him rage.
After another missed attack, Bunta growled and sprinted forward.
Bunta backstepped faster, trying to keep his distance.
Bunta's thrust had a short range, but it came in fast, powered by both his arms.
Bunta deflected it to the side, but not hard enough.
The spear tip nicked his upper arm.
It was barely a deep scratch, but it distracted Vuntha for a moment too long. Bunta was in his face, past his guard, turning his spear over in his hands. He whipped the butt of his weapon up from below. Vuntha blocked with the shaft of his own spear, stopping it from hitting his chin. Bunta jabbed forward under the block, catching Vuntha in the throat. Vuntha coughed and stumbled backward. His feet caught on something in the dark. He wobbled, then fell on his back. Bunta kicked at something, whatever Vuntha had tripped on, then marched forward. He thrust his weapon down. Vuntha batted the attack aside. Bunta's spear struck the dirt. Bunta drew it back in half a second and aimed another attack at Vuntha's stomach. Lying on the ground, Vuntha couldn't get his spear back around in time to block. He tried to roll away, but the thrust was coming in too quick. Bunta grunted, then tripped. His feet were suddenly working hard, trying to keep his balance. His spear thumped into the ground next to Vuntha's ear. Vuntha kicked out, shoving Bunta back the other way, then rolled to the side and up to his feet, bringing his spear to bear. Catran was up on one knee. He'd been the obstacle that Vuntha had fallen over. He'd pulled the knife out of his body and used it to slash at Bunta's legs. Bunta backed away, looking at Vuntha, then Catran. His left leg had a limp. Vuntha could just barely see the sheen of blood in the dark. Vuntha glanced at his sudden ally. Can you move? Catran nodded. He held the knife in one hand. His other was pressed on his wound. A dark stain was growing under his fingers. I can move long enough to kill this honorless bitch. Bunta turned and ran. Vuntha and Catran exchanged a glance. Vuntha took off after him. Catran tried to keep up, but he couldn't run in his condition. Bunta made it to the closest horse, Catran's mount. It had wandered away somewhat, startled by the fighting, but unharmed. Bunta slung himself on the animal and ushered it into a gallop, riding out into the east. You coward! Catran shouted. Traitor! After the last word, he broke into a fit of pained coughing. Catran! Vuntha ran back and supported him under the arm. That looks bad. Need a spirit guide, Catran said. He clung to Vuntha's shoulder. His breathing was pained and sporadic. Have to ride back, tell them. Vuntha nodded. Lie down, keep your hand on it. I'll run and see if I can find a horse. I don't think I got Bunta's too badly. Catran made an affirmative grunt. Vuntha lowered him back to the ground. Catran lay on his good side, holding the wound tight and squeezing his eyes shut. Vuntha scanned the horizon for the horses, cursing the clouds for blocking the moon. He squinted. He could almost make out a silhouette of a horse in the distance. It looked like it was walking toward them. More movement. Vuntha blinked. He crouched and rubbed his eyes. He wasn't sure if he was seeing it, or if the thick of the dark was swimming in his eyes. It was from crouching that he realized. The ground moved under his hands, a vibration, like that from horses or bison. Hanta had showed him that trick many times. Feeling the intensity of the earth's vibrations was a good way to gain your bearings if the herd was out of sight. This one was different, regular, rhythmic, pounding. Like a drum. A tiny green light shot up a few yards into the sky. Vuntha's eyes followed its arc. Just before it fizzled away, he saw them, illuminated against the night, rows and rows of faces. Vuntha ran back to Catran. We have to move. What? Catran protested with a groan as Vuntha lifted him up. What's going on? The Iron Men are coming. We're in their path. Vuntha shuffled Catran along as fast as he could. The sound drifted over the air a few moments later, the heavy fall of footsteps in time. The march of men going to war. Vuntha nearly dragged Catran across the ground, desperate to get around the hazy line of men and horses. He tried to stay as low as possible. Catran worked to move his feet, but it wasn't much help. He grunted at the position he had to bend with his stomach injured. Keep quiet, Vuntha said. It hurts, Catran growled. Vuntha didn't dare risk more words. They were almost around the edge of the line of soldiers. The final group of men flanking the end were clad from head to foot in spiked armor. They held massive, hooked spears. Their feet clamped into the ground with the sound of iron. And then they were past. Vuntha pulled Catran flat to the ground. Whether it was thanks to the dark, or the big helmets obscuring their sight, the two scouts went unnoticed. The darkness that had just been his foe when searching for the horses had become his greatest ally. Vuntha sent a silent prayer to the one above for denying him what he wanted in exchange for what he needed. The thick column of men roared by. Vuntha realized how they'd come up so suddenly. They were bent in a half jog, their equipment and supplies jostling in great packs and canisters dangling from their backs. They weren't using torches. They couldn't, if they wanted to stay hidden. But even with the thick dark, there were no sudden surprises out on the flatlands. They'd be at the mountain before the sun rose. Vuntha heard hooves. He ducked his head back down. A group of horses galloped by on their opposite side. He could hear them talking, exchanging strange words in a guttural tone. More horses followed behind the main march of the soldiers, and then a long column of wagons. Considering the distance they'd had to come, they must have brought plenty of supplies. That was the quiet protection of the plains. Outsiders couldn't easily survive in the open without bringing all the food they would eat, not to mention the struggle to find sources of water. Stay down, Vuntha whispered. I'll be back soon. You'll know me by the Red Sparrow's call. Red Sparrow, Catran repeated. What are you going to do against so many? Steal one of their horses, Vuntha said. He slipped into the darkness. Bunta squeezed the greenstone that was in his pocket as he rode his horse into the night. There was no answer. He squeezed it again and again. That's the third time you've bothered me,
came a voice that was not Telad's. The accent was far thicker than that of the commander.
I hope you have something important to say.
I ride for you now, Bunta shouted at the stone. I tried to kill the others, but they were two against me alone. They lost their horses in the fight.
Then we can still catch them. Where are you?
Headed toward where? Bunta trailed off. Suddenly, men were in front of him, thousands of them arranged in neat and orderly rows, spears held in the air.
I'm right in front of you. I'll send a signal.
Stay where you are. A green light flew up. Smoke trailed behind it, as if a green torch had been tossed into the sky. It didn't go very high before falling, then vanished before striking the ground. Bunta's horse snorted and stamped as the wall of men approached. He patted its mane and tightened his hold on the reins. The line of men stormed closer. Bunta raised his arm, then waved it over his head trying to draw attention to himself, but the soldiers didn't halt. He drew back in his saddle, bracing himself. Just as it seemed they would crash together, the men moved around him. Bunta watched in wonder as they flowed about him like water, without even pause. It was only then that he realized those out to the sides had spread to make room for those in the center. And then they were past him, their lines merging back together, as if nothing had happened. Bunta was suddenly amongst horses. He could hear the wheels of wagons. Men turned their faces to look at him, taking him in and muttering to themselves.
You're Telad's spy?
Bunta turned his horse to the source of the voice. A man flanked by several ironclad cavalrymen was watching him. Even in the night, his face was pale. The rest of his body seemed to merge with the dark. Bunta realized his hair and his clothing were black, or some dark color. It was hard to tell. The man didn't look like much next to the warriors. He wasn't very tall, even on his horse, and he had an average sort of face. But his eyes were bright and cold as the night.
I am, Bunta said. Where is he?
He's, the man trailed off.
I do not know the word. He is not able to speak right now.
Fine, Bunta said.
Who are you?
I am Lord Rhaegard Hale, regent select of the Emperor Adrian Calgrades and governor of the Western Kingdom, Stareth, he said.
You are Bunta, yes?
It is pronounced Bunta.
And I am son of Yucatan, elder of the Windseekers.
The man picked through his words with a precise air.
Do not raise your voice to me. Your lineage is not relevant in the Empire. Remember, if you will, that you and yours came to me to lift you out of the mud.
Bunta was not in the mood for insults, but he bit down on his anger and took a long breath.
I just came from a fight, Bunta said. I injured their horses.
They aren't far behind me, just two of them. Hale nodded. He looked to one of his guards and spoke words in their language, garbled, ugly sounds with too many consonants. The guard, who Bunta noted had a colorful plume on his shoulder, turned and shouted orders. A group of horsemen broke off and rode around the column of marching soldiers. Hale clicked at his horse and snapped his reins. His men did the same, and they started forward again behind the soldiers. Bunta tightened his knees on his horse's flanks, prodding it forward. He had a chance to glance at the wagons. Some were packed with sacks and crates, but one of them held people. They were bound in chains that were bolted to the transports, hunched over under the canvas. Bunta couldn't see them too clearly in the dark, but they didn't look excited to be along for the ride. I'll have servants like this man. Obedience like this man. I just have to be patient. He breathed slowly, trying to purge the tension from his body. Faces swam into place over the forlorn looks on the chained slaves. Everyone who'd mocked him. Hanta, Vuntha, all of the warriors. And Jackson Vidalt. He'd put him in a collar, like that yellow-haired bitch, and make him watch as he took Chalky back. When he was a knight, and Jackson was rotting in a castle dungeon, Chalky would come back on her knees. He smiled as he imagined the look on Jackson's face. Hale spoke without looking at him.
I've been in contact with Kanaya. He informed me you'd be coming just earlier. It wasn't a clean kill, but at least you stopped them from getting back to your camp. It was two against one,
Bunta said.
And you had?
Hale paused, shook his head.
They did not know you were coming against them, is what I mean to say. One of them is one of our best warriors,
Bunta said.
I stabbed him in the gut, and I nearly killed the other. I'm sure it was a terrific battle.
Bunta realized his left leg was throbbing. He looked down. It wasn't life-threatening, but he was still bleeding. The pain was coming back as his adrenaline faded.
I'm injured. Is there anyone that can treat me?
Concerning your prowess, Hale said, ignoring his request.
I'm a little disappointed. Kanaya promised better. But we'll correct the problem shortly.
Bunta took another slow breath. He already wanted to throttle this Hale. Telad had his arrogance, but he didn't ooze it from every pore like this one.
Just run them down, Bunta said. They have nowhere to hide. It's miles yet to the mountain's foothills.
Actually, Hale said,
I was talking about you.
Bunta realized there was something around his neck. There was a soft click. He whipped his head back. Bunta saw a man in black robes on a horse. His hood was pulled low, and he was already steering his mount back behind the column. When his horse's hoofs hit the ground, there was no sound, no warning to give him away. Bunta reached up. As soon as his hands touched what was there, a blue light flashed, and he felt a shock spike through his fingers and up his arms. He drew back, cursing.
Kanaya said he'd give me a formidable warrior as a gift,
Hale said.
But I think I have something like a wild dog. More bark than bite.
Bunta brought his head back to try and see the object on his neck. He couldn't get enough of an angle, but he could feel at it with his chin.
It was a stiff wooden collar. The same that the girl had worn.
I am not a dog, Bunta said. Take this off.
Now. Bunta felt fire burning in his chest, as if acid was welling up from his stomach. He clutched his abdomen and leaned forward on his horse. His mount snorted and skipped forward as it felt Bunta's knees press in.
I told you not to raise your voice to me, Hale said. You said I would be given a title, Bunta said.
He fought against the pain, pushing his concentration into his voice.
Land.
Hale made a strange face, then leaned over and said something to his men in their tongue. He pointed at Bunta. They chuckled and laughed, looking at Bunta with pitying faces. Mocking faces.
Take this off me, Bunta shouted.
You're disobeying me again. The burning in Bunta's gut was joined by the feeling of a hot iron twisting into his back. He screamed. His hands dug into his horse's flesh. The animal whinnied and turned in a circle, bucking. Distracted by the pain, Bunta fell off the side and onto the ground. He curled up in the dirt, his face and muscles clenching up as if he could push the pain out if he tried hard enough. It only burned hotter. And then it was gone. Bunta tried to breathe. His abdomen ached from the pain.
That's the proper place for a dog, Hale said.
Don't make me discipline you a third time. Bunta felt the jabbing on his legs and lower back, spikes prodding him forward.
Get up and walk.
Bunta climbed to his feet. His horse was already being led away by the reins. He looked around. A sea of faces and words he couldn't understand surrounded him. He was alone, and now he was collared, to be flogged with whips he couldn't see at the whim of this man. Bunta ran for his horse. He almost made it before the pain stopped him. It sliced across the backs of his legs, digging through the wound Katran had already made. His ankles went numb. He tripped over himself and fell face first to the ground. His nose took the impact straight on. It felt like a blade jammed into the center of his face. As Bunta turned over in the dirt, he realized the blonde girl had been unconscious not from some magical slumber, but from the pain. He could never go back to the Windseekers. He would never have lands nor servants. Kanaya had sold him as a slave.
It won't be like that, Bunta said.
It won't. He repeated the words aloud, over and over.
It won't. It won't.
He turned his face up and shouted at Hale through his tears.
I will not be your dog.
The pain started low again, then climbed up through his spine. It felt like the numbing sting of a limb that had fallen asleep, only worse. It spread out from his back, down to his hips, up to his shoulders, the bite of fire ants wrapping all over him. Hale's words were as calm and clinical as ever.
The sensation will stop when you bark like a dog.
Bunta shook his head. The pain increased in intensity. It traveled down his arms and pricked his fingers, first with needles, and then with knives, digging in under his fingernails and peeling them back. He took in a breath, growled, breathe again. He pushed his nose into the ground, using his own injury to distract himself from the more severe pain.
Barking, not growling, Hale said. Like this. Woof woof.
Bunta felt his legs twitch. He wasn't moving them. His body was acting on its own. His thoughts felt jumbled and pinched. The pain washed everything out. His mind begged him to give up, to let it go, to make it stop. His heart refused to bend. Bunta dug his nails into his palms, using the biting pain to break through the stinging. He slammed his forehead into the dirt. He rolled over and folded his arms and ground them together, fighting against the collar's enchantment. And then the pain got worse, and his heart started to bend. Bunta's instincts overrode his will. His throat rebelled against his control. He made noises in the dirt, spluttered and indistinct.
What?
Hale said.
I couldn't hear. Woof.
Bunta sprayed the sound out between his teeth.
Woof.
A little louder.
Woof. Woof. Woof.
The pain vanished. His nerves cried out in relief. His stomach churned, unable to cope with the alternation of everything at once and then nothing at all. He felt drool on his mouth. Bunta tried to clean his lips only to taste a clod of dirt. He spat onto the ground.
I always do enjoy that moment, Hale said.
The instant when the tough ones throw away their pride. He looked into the distance.
We've wasted too much time already. Walk, dog.
Bunta slowly got up. He looked at his skin. There was nothing, no cuts, no injuries that would speak of that kind of pain. He could hardly believe it was gone.
Don't fall behind, Hale said. It'll start again if you get too far from me.
They had dropped a short distance behind the column. Bunta had to jog to keep up with their horses. He ran after them with dead eyes and a cold, numb weight in his chest, deathly afraid of the wooden thing that was clasped around his neck. Bunta heard shouting Bunta's voice. He couldn't pick out the exact words of the conversation, but it didn't sound happy. He slinked between the wagons at the back of the army. The latter half of the army's column had suddenly stopped. The guards were facing forward and mumbling amongst themselves. Bunta couldn't understand their words, but it sounded like they were guessing at what was holding them up. Bunta noticed a horse being led back from further up, Katrin's horse. Why would they take Bunta's mount away? Some kind of dissension?
Good.
Bunta followed the soldier leading the horse. He kept low, darting behind the backs of the wagons and crouching against the wheels. He peeked inside each one as he went. Most were filled with sealed containers and barrels, made of wood and bits of metal. Another held stacks of spears, yet another contained piles of pointed metal rods that vaguely resembled arrows, but they seemed a bit too short to fly very well. Bunta thought they might be crossbow bolts. He'd only heard of them from Hanta.
The man leading Bunta's horse reached a wagon near the edge of the train. 6 horses were hitched to its front, more than the rest of them. It had 3 drivers, one man holding the reins with 2 armored guards seated alongside. More horses lined up along the wagon, tied to pegs on its undercarriage. The men exchanged words. Vuntha crouched on the opposite side from them, trying to keep as small and still as possible. Katrin's horse was tied off near the back. It still had Katrin's belongings, his saddlebags, quiver, and bow, all strung on the horse's flank, and most importantly, their warning horn. Vuntha glanced into the wagon. He sucked in a sharp breath. There were people under the canvas. They were naked, their ankles were chained to the inside wall of the carriage. Their shoulders were bent, their heads were lowered. Collars hung from their necks. Their skin hung as well, drooping from their bones, as if the fat and muscle had been sucked out of them. Vuntha had seen that before, during a bad winter in his childhood. Hunting had been poor. Food was stretched thin, and so too were the people. One of the slaves looked up. Sunken eyes and a gaunt face stared at him. Vuntha stared back. Slowly, he lifted a finger to his lips. The slave swallowed, then gave a single nod. Vuntha exhaled. He glanced around for a moment. He didn't know when the wagons would start moving again. He needed to take the horse and go. But he couldn't leave these people like this, hopeless and abandoned. Vuntha slipped his knife from its sheath. The slave flinched, but settled when Vuntha turned the blade, offering the hilt. The slave met Vuntha's eyes again, and this time, there was a little life in them. The man took the weapon and tucked it behind his back. Vuntha wasn't sure what the slave would do with the weapon. He couldn't cut through his chains, after all. In the worst case, if his state became unbearable, he had a way out of this world and into the next. Vuntha nodded a farewell, then went around for the horse. The beast snorted a bit, then rubbed its nose on him in a sort of greeting. The other horses stamped at the unfamiliar scent. Vuntha fumbled with the rope. His hands seemed coated in sweat. His fingers kept sliding off the frayed fibers. He'd never had so much trouble with a knot in his life. He'd never had thousands of men that wanted to kill him a stone's throw away, either. The slack fell loose, and the animal was free. Vuntha led it away as quickly as he dared, away from the carriage and into the dark. He heard another shout, louder. Bunta again. A few yards back from the wagon, Vuntha mounted up and started the horse out and wide behind the back of the army. He swept his eyes about for scouts, but the only people in his sight were turned toward the spectacle that had them stopped. He reached Katran without incident. Vuntha dropped down and helped him up.
I thought you were dead when I heard that.
Katran grunted.
Scream.
Brace yourself. Vuntha said. Vuntha shoved Katran up onto the horse. Katran let out a pained moan, but cut it off short, grinding his teeth together. Vuntha swung up on the horse in front of him. There was a shout in the distance. Vuntha heard hooves. A red light flashed from the direction of the wagons. The darkness was chased away by maroon light. Vuntha jammed his knees into the side of the horse. It whinnied, then leapt into a sprint. A chorus of gallops thudded in his ears, warning him of others fast approaching. More lights flickered from behind them.
Turn the horse left!
Katran shouted.
Now!
Vuntha didn't question it. He jerked the reins and jabbed in with his right knee. The horse darted left. A wind rushed by Vuntha's ear. An orb of fire flew past them, staining the grass with an orange-yellow glow. It struck the ground where Vuntha would have been if he'd kept straight. There was a sound like 100 drums smashed together. The orb exploded, throwing up a gout of flame and smoke. Vuntha pressed down close to the horse and urged it through the debris. The animal was in a wild-eyed panic, but it obeyed.
Can you use your bow?
Vuntha shouted.
I'll try,
Katran said. Vuntha heard the snap of a bowstring a few seconds later.
Shit!
What?
I missed!
Just keep firing! Vuntha could see the line of soldiers. They'd caught up to the front of the army. There was another light amongst the marching men, blue, this time. More horses peeled out of formation to chase them. Katran fired again.
That's one. How many left?
20 or so.
Is there more magic? What's the blue light?
Katran scanned the scene behind them.
It's getting bigger. I don't know what it is. Keep watching it. It's coming.
Which way?
I don't know.
Vuntha glanced over his shoulder. The light shifted as it crackled toward them, blue, then purple, indigo, back to blue. It seemed to warp the air around it, a single bolt of lightning summoned from the clouds. The spark split in 3, then shot forward. Vuntha pushed his knees into the horse as hard as he could. The first bolt exploded near their pursuers. A soldier and his horse were blown forward so fast they flew past Vuntha and Katran, crumpling over the dirt like ragdolls. The smell of singed hair and metal slag rose over them. The other 2 bolts exploded just behind them. Vuntha braced himself against the heat and clods of dirt. A rock smacked him in the shoulder and bounced off his head, slicing a gash across his temple. One of the saddlebags was gone, and with it, the warning horn. Vuntha shook away the pain and worked to keep the horse under control.
How many?
He shouted.
About the same.
Katran shouted back to him.
No more lights. I think they can't aim at this distance.
Why aren't they firing arrows?
They don't have bows.
Katran said.
Horsemen with no bows. Just like the stories.
Vuntha and Katran raced across the plain. They left the main body of the army behind, but they were rapidly losing ground to the riders. Their horse was trained for life on the move, but it was carrying 2 people at full gallop. Vuntha looked back just as one of Katran's arrows took a man straight through the eye. The soldier slumped in his saddle,
dragging his horse sideways and into another. Their mounts collided and slammed down into the grass at full speed.
Nice shot, Vanta said. I don't think I could have made that in the dark.
Eyes forward,
Katran shouted. There was shouting from the pack of horsemen. They split into two groups and spaced themselves further apart. Half of them swung to the left, losing ground in the chase, but setting up for a pincer attack. The other half stayed close behind, keeping the pressure on their quarry.
They're going to surround us, Katran said. There's nowhere to ride,
Vanta said. He set himself and tried to think. They had a good number of arrows left. They both had a knife. Katran's spear was rattling in its holster next to him. Strong weapons, but nothing that could turn the tide.
I'm slowing us down, Katran said. We'll be fine, Vanta shouted. Keep shooting. Vanta! They are going to kill us!
Vanta urged the horse onward, but it was starting to tire. The cavalry was closing in.
Hey! Vanta called. You used my name!
Ah! Katran said. You're no pebble. The sound of hooves rumbled in Vanta's ears, almost cutting out Katran's voice as it turned quiet.
I shouldn't have complained about my wedding. Now I'll never be Wednesday.
He lowered his face, drooping on the horse.
Tell Maliki I'm sorry. Katran!
Katran let himself fall from the horse, tucking in his arms and legs. Vanta had only tried that move a few times in his life, and never at a full gallop. He would never have dared doing it while injured. But Katran was the best of the windseekers. Vanta kept his gaze over his shoulder, watching as the warrior hit the ground. Katran let his momentum play out, rolling over the plains like a human ball. And then he was up, stopped on a knee. He raised his bow and fired as fast as he could draw arrows. The horsemen behind them dropped like flies. Katran took them down as easily as targets, one after another, striking his marks despite the near darkness. Some of his shots flew wide, but he made up for it with his rate of fire. And then his quiver was empty. Katran raised his knife, his final defense against an oncoming horseman. At the last moment, he threw it, but his torso buckled from his wound, and he missed. Vanta turned away as Katran was run down. Vanta steered his horse away from the flanking group, escaping into the hole Katran had opened. Without a second rider, his horse ran with renewed speed. The cavalrymen were clad in heavy armor, and their horses had to be tired from a long journey. He quickly made up the lost ground. Vanta blinked hard against the wind. His hands were white on the horse's reins. He had to make it back.
And then we lost him in the dark.
Hale wrapped his knuckles on his saddle and sighed through his nose. Things were not going well, and it hadn't even started. His newest acquisition was barely worth the collar, far too unstable to be trusted with anything out of sight. On top of that, the scout the dog failed to kill had managed to escape. More frustrating still, somehow, after more than 2 decades under his control, K. Telandrin had scraped up his will like moldy jam from the bottom of a broken jar, resisting him just long enough to ensure Rachel's escape. He was sure Cade didn't remember anything. Hale had pushed those memories out with pain. And yet there Cade was, denying Hale in almost the exact same way as before, like it was some sort of instinct that had been bred into him. Animals, his whole damn family. They would have seen Stareth burn before bowing to the Emperor.
Your orders, my lord?
The man asked.
Hale looked at him. The scout is lost, but we can still hit them before they organize. Row, Hilden!
The two mages rode to him, clad in their rune-marked black robes. Ren lowered his hood respectfully.
My lord? Take the full cavalry. Use your lightning matrices.
One charge.
Just one, my lord?
Hale thought for a moment.
Take a second only if an opportunity presents itself. Avoid casualties and keep them under pressure until we arrive.
Yes, my lord, he said.
What of their own mages? Their spirit women are busy with some ritual inside the mountain,
Hale said.
Even with the scout giving them warning, no?
No, this is a good thing. You'll arrive before they have a proper defense. He started to smile.
Ride hard, but don't attack outright. Give the horses a chance to rest and let the barbarians form up. Let them think they've just barely beaten our surprise. Then you strike. They have nothing to counter you with.
As you say, Ren said. He looked into the distance. Even in the dark, laid thick by the clouds, one could see the mountain. It was blacker than black, looming over them like a spike driven into the earth.
What is it, my lord?
Hale eyed the mountain. He'd felt it several days earlier, but this close, all his mages could sense it. Some power within it was stirring, like a beast scratching at the inside of its cocoon.
We'll find out soon enough, Hale said.
Chalky didn't bother wasting time trying to get back to sleep. She wandered through the camp in an attempt to bleed off her frustration. Her wandering became a forced stride, and her stride transformed into a march that involved stamping her feet into the dirt as hard as possible. After doing several circuits, she made it back to the tent in which Rachel was once again sleeping. Hanta was keeping a fire lit outside in vigil, while waiting for the return of his son. He slid a sharpening stone along one of his knives, working it to a razor edge with fine, even-handed strokes. She stood there a moment, watching him, getting her breath back. Hanta glanced up when she sat down opposite him, then returned to his knife without a greeting. He understood the reason for her wakefulness. Even if he hadn't been assigned to guard Rachel, he'd probably be doing the same with Vanta out scouting in the dark. Chalky folded her legs beneath her and watched the fire. Her thoughts swirled like the flames, flickering between worry for Jackson and a seething, riotous hatred for Bunta. Bunta.
Chalky realized her hands were clenched up where they rested on her knees. She forced them to relax. She wafted between punishments in her head. Exile was too good for him. Maybe she'd rig him to the top of his own tent, upside down, and see how long it took for him to die from the blood pooling in his head. Maybe something less complicated, dig his heart out and throw it into the nearest fire. She took another breath. Those were not the thoughts of a spirit guide. She wasn't a child any longer. Yet, for that very same reason, Bunta deserved a grave sentence for his crimes. Her fingers had balled up again. She shook her hands loose and sighed.
"You sound like Jackson," Hanta said.
Chalky looked up, watched him work on his knife for a moment. The better the edge, the more easily it would puncture iron armor.
"What makes me sound like him?" Chalky said. "Sighing?"
Hanta nodded.
"That boy is like iron that's been fired, cooled, fired again, cooled again. Very hard, but brittle. His sighs, they're like this."
He slid his whetstone across the knife, applying soft pressure, and the sound that slipped from the knife was almost like a sigh.
"Each one sharpens him. But if you work the edge too hard, it becomes vulnerable. It chips, cracks. In battle, the whole blade might snap."
Chalky put her head in her hands.
"I know. But what does?"
Something thumped on the ground next to her.
"Oil that,"
Hanta said. Chalky picked up the two objects. One was a leather sheath, for the knife he was sharpening, and the other was a small leather container with a cloth stuffed in the mouth. The container held a mix of seed oil and rendered bison fat. She glanced at Hanta. He hadn't bothered looking up. But she knew that his brusque request was not rude. He simply trusted her to take care of it without further instruction. She withdrew the cloth, wiping the excess oil on the inside of the lip of the container. She rubbed it onto the outside of the sheath, then worked the oil into the hide with her bare fingers, almost as if she was massaging a muscle. It was simple, straightforward work. When oiling leather, a little would go a long way, but it needed frequent care and attention. Every bit had to be well coated to protect it from drying out. If that happened, it would begin to crack and tear. Leather was too difficult to produce to waste it so casually. Her father taught her this, when Pala was too young and he needed a spare hand. How to maintain the tent. Care for a horse. Sharpen a knife or an arrow. And the bison, he taught her everything about that animal. How to cut the animal to preserve the largest portion of the hide and the fur. Which parts to butcher, and which parts to leave for the scavengers. How to make containers from the organs of the bison, bladder, stomach, heart. How to separate the sinew into string, and weave the string into thread or bowstring. How to grind the hooves into powder, and use it to create glue. How to thank Mother Earth, and give prayer to the soul of the bison in exchange for everything it had given. And when he died, she went to Hanta, and Hanta kept teaching her. How to use that bow. How to fight with a spear. Finished with the sheath, she set it aside, a bit away from the fire. Fire would dry it too quickly. The leather needed time to absorb the oils.
"Feeling better?"
Hanta asked. He checked his knife against the firelight, then set the tools aside.
"A little," Chalky said. "People are like leather,"
Hanta said.
"A little care, more than a little often,"
Chalky said, finishing the sentence with him. Hanta smiled.
"You always were a quick learner. But it's true. Don't try to hold it all in, Chalky. You'll tear, crumble at the seams. A little oil now and then, everyone needs some. Even Shaka, if you can believe it. I don't know if I can."
Hanta's smile turned into a grin.
"That leathery old woman has absorbed her fair share of oil. But don't tell her I said that. The part about her leathery skin, or her being old?
Both." A little smile wormed across Chalky's lips.
"Hmm. I think she appreciates Jackson. More than you know."
Chalky looked at Hanta. He wasn't looking at her, but out into the dark. His eyes were distant. Chalky thought about her teacher and mentor. Her second mother, Shaka. She had no children. Her husband died before Chalky was born. Shaka's past was a thing that was not spoken of in the tribe, but Chalky could make educated guesses. Jackson might be filling a hole that Shaka had quietly carried for a long, long time. Her thoughts turned back to the present. Chalky took a breath, then spoke.
I can't believe no one else called out Bunta.
Chalky pointed over Hanta's shoulder.
He attacked me right in that tent. The only person that defended me was Vanta. You accused him of murder,
Hanta said.
Attempted murder, at least. That's a serious crime. Much more so than him showing disrespect to his elders, even to a spirit guide. You can't expect the tribe to hoist him from his leggings at your word alone.
Chalky put a hand on her chest, just below her neck.
I don't know him anymore, she said. He tried to choke me to death, Hanta. His eyes, if you saw his eyes, you'd understand. He hates me. Hates us. Something's terribly wrong in his soul. His spirit is unbalanced.
Hanta folded his arms.
We will find the truth of this, and if Bunta is guilty of what you've claimed, then we will punish him appropriately. Do you believe me?
I do, Hanta said.
Because I must. Though I hope Bunta is not beyond saving. He wasn't born selfish and petty, as he is now. He can still be the man he was meant to be.
I can see it in him.
I can't,
Chalky said. Do not judge so quickly, Chalky. Kunaya may be arrogant, but he did make a good point. Everyone's heads were hot. He tried to take my innocence from me, Hanta.
Chalky said.
When I was near the creek, away from camp. He tried to force me.
Hanta's face darkened.
So, that's what happened. Why didn't you say anything then?
Jackson stopped him.
Chaki said. And I had no evidence. Nothing but our word. We told Shaka. She said she would speak to Yucatan. And now, nothing has happened, and I am again only with my word. Yucatan is afraid to condemn his son. Damn. Hanta said. That boy, that fool of a boy. What are you waiting for, Hanta? Chaki asked. Why won't you tell Yucatan what he's like? Kunaya means to turn everyone against me because he is close with Bunta. I could hear the intent within his words. It's not so simple. Hanta said. If I come out against Yucatan's heir, he'll perceive it as an attack on himself, his family, and authority. I have no wish to start some kind of feud. If Yucatan cannot see the forest for the trees, she said, then he isn't fit to guide us through it. You should be very careful with words like that. Hanta said. Our tribe has already been pressed into the southeast hunting grounds after last year. Why do you think Bunta's situation has been allowed to fester? We can't afford disturbances in our leadership, not now. If we don't afford them now, Chaki said, we'll never be able to afford them at all. I can't walk in the daylight next to that disgusting, murderous rat any longer. There isn't. Hanta paused. He rubbed two fingers across his eyebrow, then said himself. You have your point. I will take in Bunta more closely. I will refocus him on his training until some judgment can be passed. And it will be passed. But you will keep your opinions to yourself. Inflaming people against Yucatan will not solve the problem of Bunta. Even if he is blind in this matter, he is a good leader. Chaki wasn't happy with that pronouncement, but at least he met her halfway. She folded her arms and nodded. I will do as you say. But I won't let stop. Hanta said, raising his palm. Chaki closed her lips and blinked. Hanta held his hand out still, his head cocked to the air. And then she heard it. Hooves galloping. Vuntha burst out of the darkness, bringing his horse off the main path and to their fire. He slid off his animal and ran toward them, stumbling. He caught himself against the ground with his hands and kept going. His shoulder had a gash. Blood ran down part of his arm. An angry welt marked his forehead. More blood was dried around his eye. Bits of mud spotted his clothes. Chaki and Hanta were on their feet in an instant. They steadied him as he reached them. Chaki reached inside and grabbed her essence, using her free hand to draw runes in the air. She shoved her power into them, and the healing spell flowed into Vuntha, sealing his cuts. The welt shrunk, then faded. Spirits, Hanta said. What happened? Where are the others? Bunta, Vuntha said. He was exhausted from the ride, though not as exhausted as his horse looked. Betrayed. He betrayed us. Catran is dead. Iron men are coming. Hanta ran back and grabbed the horn resting on the side of Rachel's tent. He blew into it, moving his lips to form two different notes. He drew another long breath, and played the notes again. Chaki knew the warning very well. Every man, woman, and child of the people under the mountain knew it. Imminent danger. The horns of other windseekers sounded first, repeating the call, and then their neighbors, the dust gatherers. The horns echoed their two-note song in the valley of the foothills under the mountain. The sprawling camp woke up like an anthill churning to life. Fires flared up, islands of light blossoming in the darkness. Chaki could hear shouting in the distance. Hanta blew his horn again once the first wave of warnings had died out, indicating where it had started. Warriors flocked to him. Some of them were only half-clothed, but all of them brought their spears. A few came mounted, quivers and bows strapped to their horses. Their small campfire and Rachel's tent was surrounded by a surging crowd in less than a minute. Yucatan shoved his way through the gathering. Hanta! Vuntha? His eyes darted. Where is Bunta? Where is my son? Bunta sold us to the Iron Men, Vuntha said. The crowd began to settle. Everyone exchanged glances. Yucatan's face screwed up in confusion. I don't understand. What happened out there? Catran! Came a shout. Maliki pushed in behind the elder. Catran! She looked around the circle, searching for her betrothed. Drana was right behind her. The shorter girl ran past, flinging herself toward Vuntha. Vuntha grunted, hugged her, then moved her aside. I have to tell them, Drana. I was afraid, she said. Vuntha kissed her cheek, then stepped into the ring of warriors. The Iron Men are coming in force, with an army. They'll be here in less than a half finger of the sun. I think they were going to try and surprise us, kill us in our sleep. But what of Bunta? One man asked. He betrayed us, Vuntha said. He stabbed Catran in the back, then tried to kill me. I held him off, and Catran didn't die so easily. He fled when both of us went for him. I barely escaped their riders. Where is Catran? Maliki shrieked. Vuntha lowered his head. Bunta injured one of our horses. I couldn't find it before the Iron Men were on top of us. Catran said two riders to one mount would get us both killed. He looked up at Maliki, meeting her gaze firmly. He died with honor, shooting them down so I could escape. He killed at least 10 before he fell. No. Maliki fell to her knees. She cupped her face with her hands. Silence hung over them. My son, a traitor? Yucatan said. Bunta wouldn't, there must be some mistake. Vuntha, are you? He screamed at me about how he'd make us all his slaves. Vuntha said. He tried to kill me. There was no mistake. If you hadn't had your ears stuffed with pride, this wouldn't have happened. Vuntha! Hanta said. He is your elder. He's an idiot. Vuntha shouted. Every single person in the tribe knew what Bunta was, except him, because he refused to acknowledge it.
because blood was more important to him than his people. And now,
Vuntha patted his shoulder. His cut was healed, but the scab lingered. Now we bleed instead.
Is it enough yet, elder? Are you going to listen to Chaki now? You will recant those words,
Hanta said.
Or you are not my son.
Hanta, Yucatan said. They all turned toward the elder. The man was staring at Maliki.
Vuntha has spoken true.
Elder. Yucatan's face was clenched tight. Tears fell from his eyes, sliding down his cheeks.
Once, I can look away. Twice, I should not have looked away. And now, thrice, Vuntha's words are hard, but they are true.
Rally yourself, Yucatan, Hanta said.
For what purpose?
He said.
I was blind. Spirits, my son. My only son has set our enemies on us, in this most sacred of places. I have no honor left.
Chaki felt the sharp and heady relief of validation as the elder admitted Vuntha was right. But now, with Catran dead, and Yucatan in this state, that feeling was stamped under a rising sense of dread. The Iron Men were coming. And then she had a worse thought, the realization that she was the kind of person who would first feel satisfaction at being right, rather than pity for a man who lost his son to heartless wolves. She turned away, hiding her expression from the fire, concealing it within the dark. She couldn't bear the thought of others seeing her face. Here it was, welcoming her with open arms, revenge. Bunta discredited, revealing himself as a traitor. And all she could see was the night. She was no spirit guide. She was just a selfish girl, daydreaming. Something sparked at her from the darkness. The bond with Jackson. A gold line like fine, twisting fire. She could tell he was still far away, but for some reason, he seemed incredibly close. She grasped the bond with Jackson for a moment, feeling it in her hands, using the distant warmth to firm her resolve. She was not a girl. Not anymore. She was Jackson's North Star, Polaris, the great light that guided men across oceans as vast and empty as the plains. And she had to be that light, now more than ever.
Yucatan,
she said, turning back to the fire.
We need our elder now more than ever.
I am not fit to lead, he said.
You tried to tell me hours ago, Chaki. But you led us since I knew what an elder was.
Chaki shouted. She grabbed his shoulder.
You made a mistake. But he was your son. I won't condemn you because you love your son. Until Shaka returns, I am your spirit guide.
And these, she pointed out over the group.
These are your warriors. Lead us. I will follow you against the Iron Men,
Hanta said. As I followed you against the Drawn Bows, and the East Walkers before that, and the Iron Men themselves before that.
Their armor will not save them if we fire enough arrows.
Hanta raised his spear up with his words, shouting. The other warriors raised their weapons, spears, bows, knives, fists. When the war cry died, there was an energy in the air, almost like the energy of essence, ready to be pushed into a rune, the untapped force of people ready to work together to fight and survive. Yucatan wiped his face with the back of his hand. He straightened, and looked at them all with reddened eyes.
I want every warrior on his horse. Gather our mounts from the herd. Meet at the eastern edge of the camp.
The men shouted again. Those on horseback rode back down the main path between the teepees to retrieve the horses. War cries carried into the night. Yucatan looked at those still gathered.
This is not another tribe. The Iron Men do not know honor, and they want no part of it. They will not count coup or show mercy, they will try to kill you. And so you must kill them first. Bring your spears, your bows, and all your arrows.
Spare nothing.
If we don't beat them, we won't lose hunting grounds. We will lose our lives.
He looked at Hanta.
We need to coordinate with the other tribes. Ride to the Three Hills and rouse Kanaya, if he isn't already awake. If they outnumber us, we'll have to.
A commotion in the back of the crowd made Yucatan trail off. Men to the side parted for riders. Chaki was surprised to see Hanik, the man who'd been responsible for the spear tournament's lottery tent.
Elder Yucatan, I've come from Jalak. What caused the warning? The Iron Men have brought an army to attack us.
Hanik swore.
But this is good timing, Yucatan said. Their foolish attack only serves to unite us as one. We'll beat them back once and for all. Tell Jalak we will ride with the Three Hills. Is Kanaya with him?
Kanaya is gone, Hanik said.
He and his tribe are nowhere to be found. They didn't even take their tents. It's as if demons stole them into the night. We thought you would know something. Did the Iron Men already attack?
No. No. Yucatan's eyes moved as he thought, jumping between the faces around him.
Bunta.
And now,
Kanaya.
Kanaya has betrayed us. Yucatan's lingering sadness transformed before Chaki's eyes. His expression turned dark, until it was like the black rock of the mountain.
I knew Bunta wouldn't go so far on his own. I left him to Kanaya's council, thinking it good for him to know the strength of a powerful leader. But he was a rotten demon all along. Kanaya has given us up to the Iron Men and abandoned us for dead.
Elder, Hanik said. No man of the tribes is capable of that much.
Not here, under the very sight of Shao Kahn.
Then where are they? Yucatan demanded.
I do not know,
Hanik said. He looked out over the camp from atop his horse.
To have moved all their people without anyone noticing, they would have had to start hours ago.
Then this was well planned, Yucatan said.
They'll know our strategies, our weaknesses.
Vuntha!
Elder?
Vuntha said.
How long until the Iron Men reach us?
On horses soon, Vuntha said. But most of them are on foot.
They'll take longer, perhaps till sunrise. And the horsemen have no bows.
No bows? Hanta said.
Just as before. We'll ride around them and whittle them down. They won't be able to touch us.
They have powerful magic, Vanta said.
They can summon light spirits that fly like arrows and spew forth fire, but their aim is poor. We have to stay at a distance.
We need space for that to work,
Yucatan said. They know we have to protect the camp. If Kanaya is a traitor, then he will burn, Hanuk said.
But that aside, he is only half the three hills.
Jalak will ride with you.
I will gather our warriors. They can't possibly outnumber us.
I don't think so, Bunta said.
But it was hard to tell.
At least 1,000, maybe more.
Tell Jalak to send the women and children around the shoulder of the mountain, along the running path,
Yucatan said.
We cannot let them be trapped in the valley.
Hanuk nodded, turned his horse, and rode off. Yucatan grabbed Chaki's shoulder.
Rouse Landry and the other women.
Get them organized, start moving the children out of harm's way.
When it's done, get your horse and your weapons and meet us on the eastern side of camp.
You'll have Chaki fight?
Hanta asked.
You train me yourself, Hanta,
Chaki said.
I can wield a spear at least as well as Vanta.
I am not questioning your ability to stand with us,
Hanta said.
The children will need someone to protect them.
Shaka and the others cannot emerge until the sun rises,
Yucatan said.
Only magic can counter magic, and we will need a healer.
Until she returns, Chaki is our spirit guide.
As you say, elder, Hanta said.
I don't think they'll send their horsemen far from their footmen,
Yucatan said.
They'll not want to let their troops be vulnerable to other horses.
We should have a short time to prepare before they.
Another horn sounded from the eastern side of camp. This time it was three notes, high, low, and then high again, a pattern used only when the tribes made war.
Enemy sighted.
Demons and dead sons,
Yucatan swore.
To the east, through camp. Chaki, stay here and get the children away. Meet us when you can.
The warriors rushed off, Hanta and Yucatan leading them between the tents. Others were still coming in from the sides, many on horseback. Some led trains of horses that had been tied together in an attempt to get them where they were needed. Men haphazardly hopped onto animals that weren't theirs. It was a serious breach of decorum, but there were only two categories of things that mattered at the moment: first, protecting the camp, and second, everything else.
Chaki rushed to Malaki. She'd stopped crying, but she was huddled on the ground, head folded between her legs.
Malaki! Get away from me!
Malaki slapped her hands away.
We have to move. The Iron Men are attacking.
He's dead, Malaki said. Her voice cracked.
My husband is dead. He died to protect you,
Chaki said.
Malaki looked up at that.
He used his last strength to make sure Vanta would make it back and warn us.
He is a hero. Are you going to waste his sacrifice sitting there, or are you going to get up?
Malaki took Chaki's outstretched hand and got to her feet.
Chaki ushered her forward.
Get your family. Tell them to warn everyone else. Do you understand?
Malaki nodded, sniffing back the tears and wiping her nose with her hand.
I hear your words. We're moving behind the mountain,
Chaki said.
Drana, you do the same for yours.
She looked between them.
We can't waste time checking teepees over and over. If a tent is empty, tell the family to just leave the entrance flap untied and open. We'll be able to tell at a glance.
Drana nodded, jogging at her side as they went. The camp was boiling with confusion. The warriors had shouted words at a few people as they went, but most didn't know what was happening.
Chaki, Drana said. I'm sorry. About before.
Chaki shook her head.
I was wrong, the way I, we can talk about it later. After this is over.
After, Drana said. Malaki pointed.
There. On the next hill.
The sky was just starting to take on the gray haze of dawn, marking the start of a cloudy day. Against that backdrop, Chaki could faintly see men on horseback, hundreds of them clustered together. In front of them was a long slope downhill, which flattened for a short stretch, before rising up to another hill on which most of the camp was located. For a moment, Chaki was afraid that they'd been caught unprepared, but warriors of the tribes were massing on their own side of the dip. Men and horses from each of the five tribes were pouring in from all sides of the encampment. Spears and packed quivers were being slung at everyone with empty hands. They formed a line at the edge of the high ground. It was a relief to see the enemy hesitating. They seemed disorganized from their long ride, milling at the top of their hill. High-pitched horns squealed out in an attempt to instill some kind of organization in their ranks. Perhaps they didn't expect such a speedy response to their presence. Chaki's heart rose further as she observed their own numbers. Those already gathered outnumbered the enemy cavalry 3-1. Drana, Malaki, and Chaki split up, running through the camp and shouting warnings. Chaki found her own tent. Landry and Pala were already outside, throwing water containers and a few sacks of wasna together on a litter.
Chaki, what's happening?
Landry said.
You can see them,
Chaki said, pointing.
The Iron Men have come to attack us.
Yucatan wants all the women and children behind the shoulder of the mountain, out of the way of the battle.
Landry nodded.
Are you to be with us?
I'm going to help them fight, Chaki said.
Tell everyone to leave their tent flap open if they've left.
Pala picked something up off the ground, their father's spear.
Mother, I'm going to fight.
Absolutely not, Landry said.
Jackson is in the mountain, he said. I have protect our family.
Chaki grabbed the spear and pulled it from his hands. Pala tried to take it back. She flipped the end and bopped him on the side.
He took a step away from the strike.
Chaki, give it back.
No,
Chaki said.
This spear is mine. It will be yours someday.
That is not today.
It is my right,
Pallas shouted.
I am the man of our tent. I have to fight.
Chaki grabbed Pallas' arm and waited until he looked at her. She let his wrist go, then leaned forward and cupped his cheek.
My brother, you are going to listen to me, and you are going to do exactly as I say. You are going to go with our mother and protect the women and children if the Iron Men try to go around us. Do you understand me?
Chaki searched his eyes.
Do you understand?
Pala nodded.
Yes. I love you,
she said.
You're strong, and you never give up. You're just like father.
Pala's eyes widened, and his lips trembled. Chaki glanced at Landry. Her mother gave just a single nod. Chaki forced her feet to move before they rebelled against her control, leaving her family behind her. She ran through the camp, shouting at tents that had closed flaps, double-checking those that had been left open. She ushered them to abandon their possessions and flee with whatever water and food they could walk with. When she looked back over the way she'd come, there were two waves of people. One of fighters, bearing spears and bows, riding horses, headed for the eastern edge of camp. The second was all women and children, rushing through the tents between the lines, retreating to the west and around the mountain. The high-pitched horn squealed again. Chaki whipped her head back the other way. The Iron Cavalry had formed up and were charging down the hill in a massive arrowhead made from horses. Chaki frowned. Something wasn't right. They'd have to charge all the way back uphill to get at the tribes, and surely they knew they'd be doing it under a rain of arrows. It was a horrible tactical decision. No time to debate strategy. That was what Yucatan and the elders were for. She joined a group of warriors headed for the front lines. By the paint on their faces, she thought they might be from the Dust Gatherers. They recognized her status as an apprentice from her neckbeads and clapped her back in welcome. They could hear the hooves in the distance. The ground rumbled. The charge was gaining speed. Shouts went up from the tribesmen that had already taken position, orders to hold ground and prepare to fire. Hundreds of bows were knocked.
Chaki!
Chaki looked over, another apprentice. She was about the same height as Chaki, a bit thinner, her hair woven in a long ponytail. They'd met at one of the meetings. She was an apprentice from the Drawn Bows.
Fine!
Fine joined her side behind the spearmen.
Today we get to kill Iron Men,
Fine said.
It's about time. I'm sick of our own tribes making war.
Chaki thought that the bravado was best saved until after the innocent were safe from harm, but she forced a smile.
I can only hope it goes well. This is good for you,
she said.
Wasn't your father killed by the Iron Men? I'll help you get your vengeance.
Vengeance again. Is that what I want?
They're coming,
Chaki said.
Get your runes ready.
Ah, Fine grunted.
I wish we could help our warriors, but we have to be defensive for now.
The apprentices were all taught a certain way. Alongside a general education regarding the lore and history of their people, there were the runes. First they had to memorize all the runes, and then they practiced healing, repair craft, and magical defense. Only when they became full spirit guides were they shown how to enhance the fighting power of a warrior. It was the most fearsome and dangerous magic, and the knowledge therefore carried great responsibility. Their powers would have to be enough to hold until the spirit guides returned. They had made it to the back of the lines. The spearmen merged with those already in position. Most had laid those weapons on the ground and drawn their bows. Chaki was tall enough to see how they'd arranged themselves. Their horsemen were at the center, facing the point of the Iron Men's oncoming wedge. Warriors on foot stood on either side in a long line. More were joining as she watched, thickening the force at a tremendous rate. Chaki looked back over the field, watching the oncoming soldiers. Even with all the defenders standing before her, the huge weight behind the oncoming charge made her heart skip up in her throat. They all wore the same colors, dark green or black. It was hard to tell in the low light. She was warm from running, but the air was cold. It was sharp on her nose and scentless. She could see her breath, and the breaths of the men around her, almost like little clouds of white essence coming from their lungs. There was a shout from the center. It was repeated down the line, called out by the elders and head warriors in turn.
Loose! Fire arrows! Fire!
Chaki watched in a sort of fascinated horror as arrows flew into the sky, more than she had ever seen in her entire life. They were a pointed flock of vipers hissing up into the air, thin snakes barely visible against the clouds. Each sting meant death. The enemy charge had just made it to the middle of the long flat between the hills. There was no way they could stop short, and even if they did, the cloud of arrows was so great that half of them would still be slain. The arrows reached the top of their arc and began to fall. Many men were about to die. Chaki sucked in her breath and forced herself to watch. She felt essence.
Chaki,
Fine said.
Lights. They're using magic. Don't let your guard down,
Chaki shouted.
Watch for magic.
The warriors near her shifted. Some looked her way. A nearby chieftain shouted her warning down the line. She heard it repeated several times. It was an odd feeling. She was younger than many of them, lighter of frame, without the scars and war paint and feathers that they bore, yet they took her words seriously. But then, it was all they had to go on. Blue light sparked over the charge of the Iron Men. It came from two points, one near the tip of the wedge, and one near the back. There was a sound like the crack of lightning, and a blue bolt shot between the two points, connecting them together. Chaki felt a huge wave of magic pour over her, as if 20 spirit guides had all cast the same spell at once.
There was a roar in the air, a reverberating voice, calling out in a tongue that bit at the edges of her soul. Men around her covered their ears. She forced herself to keep her hands at her sides. The beam of lightning connecting the two riders crackled and snapped, and grew, spreading out over the oncoming horsemen in a massive shield. The arrows fell into the construct and vanished. No, they were turned to ash, vaporized by the lightning. A cloud of the stuff roiled over the horsemen, and they galloped through it without pause. Some arrows pierced the magic, mostly those on the edge of the spell. A dozen or so riders were culled from the charge, but the wedge was intact, coated in lightning, and halfway up the hill. The spell didn't fade. Chalky was stunned. There was no way they could maintain that amount of energy between just two spirit guides. For a moment, to shield themselves, maybe. But not sustained like this. She realized that the lightning was not a shield. It was meant as a weapon. And it was heading straight for them. Shouts came from the warriors to fire more arrows. Men that had already restrung their bows began to fire. The oncoming charge was pelted with a sporadic wave of projectiles, but they were all destroyed by the crackling heat.
Fine, Chalky said. The same as me. Repel magic.
She shouted toward the warrior that had relayed her warning before.
Tell them to stop firing arrows and get their spears. Brace with your spears. The apprentices have to repel magic.
The man shouted down the line, but Chalky could barely hear it. Everyone was shouting, cursing, looking to those at their sides for instruction. The thunder of oncoming hooves and magic rumbled over it all, drowning out individual sounds. The men directly near her, at least, did raise their spears. She desperately wove runes, working alongside Fine. They cast nearly the same spell, several lines of symbols that were variations on the same thing, protect the people in front of them. The obvious struck her with only seconds remaining. Chalky wove another line into her spell. It would cost more essence, but she prayed to Shakan that it would work better. Repel lightning. It looked like whoever was at the center had ordered a countercharge downhill. A wave of their warriors surged forward. It wasn't long before they met the tip of the wedge. The impact was crushing. Opposing horses, muscled animals weighing dozens of stones, slammed into one another at full speed. The riders were thrown about like twigs. Spears and lances bent, twisted, and splintered. Flesh ripped and pulverized. The magic sparked, crashed, flashed. Blue light flickered over the front of the wedge, chewing its way across the grass like the maw of a great blue monster. It was erratic, but where it struck, warriors were sent flying backward, their skin cracked and blackened like meat cooked over a fire too long. Chalky saw a man's arm simply explode on contact with the lightning. His spear vaporized, his body trampled a heartbeat later. Fine was screaming at her. It was like the distant chirps of a bird under the roar of noise from the colliding armies. Chalky turned her head to the side. Her hair seemed to whip around her, slowly. Everything was slow. Fine pointed her finger. Essence. She hadn't pushed magic into her spell yet. Chalky threw her power into it as the wedge struck their portion of the line. Fine and Chalky's efforts produced a purple-tinged glow over their warriors, radiating from their skin like a fog. The lightning snapped against it, then bounced away like rubber, deserting the horsemen. Chalky immediately felt a huge drain on her reserves. The effort had cost her. Her blue essence bar dropped to less than a quarter of its full capacity. The armored horses crushed into the line, but without the lightning protecting them, they were vulnerable to the spears leveled at their mounts. Some few riders were able to force their way through, hacking away with heavy sabers, but a larger part of the charge was stopped dead by the bristling rows of spears. Chalky released her magic. Fine looked exhausted, but her face was twisted in a sharp expression of triumph. A sword went in for her neck. Chalky dove forward, shoving Fine down. The sword took her throat instead. It was a very strange sensation, to have a sword pass through her neck. She could feel the edge cut into her skin. The body of the saber entered her throat. For a half second, she couldn't breathe. Her windpipe was blocked. And then it was through. Chalky felt dazed. Her red health bar blinked with a floating number, and then it dropped by 2/3. You've taken a critical hit. You're stunned for 5 seconds. Chalky's arms and legs felt numb. She could move, but it felt as though she was underwater. A little picture appeared under her status bars, a stick man drawing with little yellow marks coming from its sides. A number in the corner was already counting down from 5. She looked up at the horseman. The soldier had already turned his gaze away, assuming she'd fallen. He wielded his long saber against an oncoming spearman. The counter hit 0, and the box vanished. Chalky's body leapt back under her control. She gripped her weapon with both hands and shoved it into the back of the horseman's leg, where his armor was thinnest. Her father's spear dug into the back of his calf. The man's face wrenched up in pain. His eyes turned to look at her from under his helmet. She saw confusion, fear. Chalky twisted the spear deeper. And then an arrow slammed into his face. Chalky wrenched her spear free. The dead soldier fell from his horse. She looked to see that Fine had fired from the ground. Chalky rushed over and pulled her to her feet. Fine looked at her, eyes scanning Chalky's neck, and then her face.
How are you alive?
Shakan's power, Chalky said. From Tatanka Ska. Their section of the line had held, along with several others, but the bulk of the horsemen had gotten through. The lightning magic was gone, but the line was in total disarray. Packs of horsemen were running down isolated warriors. Attempts to organize and surround the horsemen were cut short with explosions of magic. Dust filled the air, churned up from spells, trampling hooves, and feet.
What do we do?
Fine shouted.
Follow me,
Chalky said.
Heal me. I barely have any essence left,
Fine said.
She ran behind Chaki.
Where are we going?
Toward that,
Chaki shouted.
Chaki could feel the pulses of essence roaring just before each explosion. There were two of them, two magicians. Smaller flickers here and there grabbed at her attention, other apprentices, healing, protecting what they could. It was only a matter of time before the mages took advantage of the melee to attack the others. Chaki had to take the offensive. She had Shikan's power. She could survive what others could not.
You aren't injured,
Fine said.
I should save my essence.
Just do it,
Chaki shouted. I can't explain.
Three horsemen were running toward them. Chaki crouched low and braced her spear against the ground. Fine dove next to her and readied her bow. A volley of arrows slammed into the riders from the side, turning them into pincushions. One of the horses fell, screaming. The dead soldiers slumped on the other two mounts, bodies bobbing in their saddles. With no commands, the horses simply ran around Chaki's spear, avoiding harm. Their saviors were a group of men that had formed around Jalak. Chaki could see his headdress between the arms and heads. He pointed in another direction, back down the hill. The men drew their bows again. Chaki felt a surge of essence. A mage was heading toward them, drawn by Jalak's temporary success.
Start healing me!
Chaki shouted. The mage arrived flanked by 10 horsemen. He wore a black robe, but no iron armor. Blue runes were being drawn in front of his face, some Chaki knew, others she didn't recognize. His other hand held a sharp black box, darker even than his robes. Chaki noticed his hood turned toward her and Fine. She couldn't see his eyes under the cowl, but she could feel his gaze. She shivered. A shout came from behind Chaki, Jalak. A flurry of arrows whizzed across the space toward the soldiers. The man raised his box. The runes were sucked into it, and in return, it expelled lighting, wrapping the horsemen in a miniature version of the spell they'd used before. The arrows were vaporized. The lightning gathered together into a tight, roiling ball, then surged forward. It struck the ground in front of Jalak's forces, exploding with white-hot sparks. Screams split the air as men were burned and tossed away. Chaki was running. This was her chance, between spells. She sprinted toward the horsemen, holding her spear with both hands. She could see her red health bar starting to fill back up. Fine was casting. She reached the first horseman. His eyes narrowed under his helm. He swiped down at her with his saber. Arrogant. Chaki easily ducked below his swing and smacked his wrist with the tip of her spear, giving it a good gash. He shouted and turned his horse. And then she was between them, ducking under the horses, faking jabs at the heads of the animals to frighten them. The mage had been watching her the whole time. He was drawing with his hand, dancing out the runes as fast as his fingertip could move. It was a different spell, shorter. But not short enough. A saber came in, slashing at her arm, but Chaki took the blow, letting it cut her. A red line blazed across her skin, and her shoulder went numb, but it was nothing compared to the strike from before. The magician drew back in his saddle. He didn't expect her to keep moving. She had him. She leapt forward, extending her spear out in a lunge straight for his chest. A rune expanded in front of him, the lines of a protective spell. Her spear clashed against it with the sound of steel on steel. She grunted and pushed harder, but the spell didn't budge. It made no sense. He'd been drawing totally different magic. She'd read the runes. And then she saw them, more runes, flashing on the inside of his clothes. Enchantments? But where is he getting the essence? The man cocked his head and said something in his language. She saw a smirk under his cowl. Lightning exploded. Chaki was flung backwards through the air, over the horseman. She hit the ground hard, then rolled, coming to a stop on her back. It hurt. Searing pain shot up her arms. She forced her eyes open. Her hands were blackened and burned. She looked into the corner of her vision. Her health bar was pulsing with an ugly tone. It was empty. Her stomach churned. Fine's face came into view. Her hands grabbed Chaki under the arms, dragging her back across the ground. Others were nearby, men with spears surrounding her. Heads and feet around her blurred with the sky. The pain stopped her from focusing her eyes. Her ears felt stuffed with cloth. Horses. People. Shouting, screaming. It started to fade. Slowly, the pain drained away. She tried to blink, move her hands. She could feel her fingers.
Chaki? Chaki, can you hear me? Chaki!
Hanta?
Thank you, spirits.
Hanta said. He pulled Chaki up and hugged her.
You gave me a little scare there.
What happened?
What's going on?
Hanta helped her to her feet. Chaki sucked in a breath. Warriors were laid out on the ground in rows. All of them were injured. The line of men stretched out across the top of the hill. It smelled like blood and sweat and dirt. Chaki didn't know the name of the apprentice that had just healed her, but she recognized her. The girl, not older than 15, gave her a nod, then moved to the next man. He was cradling his arm to his chest. Three of his fingers were gone.
They retreated a few minutes after you fell,
Hanta said.
Whatever you did stopped that mage from casting more magic.
They blew on their horns and galloped back through the hole they made. Hanta patted her shoulder.
You saved a lot of men.
She turned, looking around. The top of the hill was obliterated. The grass was gone, pulverized to mud. Smoking holes marked where magic spells had detonated. Warriors wandered around, gathering the fallen and moving the injured to where they could rest or be healed. But there were far too few apprentices for so many casualties, and they were already drained from the fighting.
Most of the girls were huddled behind the wounded, meditating, already spent.
I didn't save anyone, Chalky said.
You did what you could,
Hanta said.
If it wasn't for you, many more would be dead.
They might not have left.
Chalky looked out into the valley. She could see a few of the Iron Men's horsemen, keeping a presence on the high ground, but the rest had retreated somewhere behind their hill. She couldn't tell if dawn had come or not. The clouds were a uniform white blanket, featureless. The sun was hidden somewhere behind them.
We won't survive if they charge like that again, Chalky said.
We're more resilient than you believe, I think,
Hanta said.
We still have numbers on our side.
Chalky swayed.
She took a step. Hanta caught her under her arm.
You shouldn't have gotten up so quickly.
Lay down.
I'm fine, Chalky said, pushing him back.
Just a little dizziness.
I'll be fine.
Hanta didn't look convinced, but the sound of hooves stopped him from voicing that opinion. The oncoming rider was Honik. He brought his horse up to them.
Chalky, I'm glad to see you standing. I wouldn't have been alive if you didn't tell the apprentices to protect us.
I didn't think I was heard.
You were,
he said.
Hanta, I found Vanta.
He's well.
Hanta let out a breath.
Chalky could almost see the tension seep from his face.
And?
Several hundred are dead,
Honik said.
But they didn't reach the tents. Most of the encampment has left safely.
But Yucatan, he was near the tip of the charge.
The magic killed him.
Demon fuck sons of whores, Hanta said.
Despite herself, Chalky was taken aback. Hanta had sworn more in the past few hours than she'd ever heard him swear in her entire life.
He wanted to make up for Bunta, Hanta said.
He couldn't let himself just lead. He had to get in there and fight against lightning.
Damn.
Jalak, at least, is still alive,
Honik said.
As are most of the other elders. We think they might be done for the day, letting the rest of the troops catch up to their horses.
We have to watch for that magic, Hanta said.
If Kanaya is with them, they have to know we can't stop it again.
Maybe he isn't the traitor Yucatan thought him to be,
Honik said.
Right now, we have to assume they know that our spirit guides are in the mountain,
Hanta said, folding his arms.
We need to expect another attack.
They'll try to hit us again, while we're vulnerable.
No,
Chalky said.
They can't, not so soon.
Why?
Hanta said.
Essence, Chalky said.
That attack they used, between all the apprentices, maybe we'd have enough essence to accomplish it.
And in the melee, they kept casting spells.
They must have had gemstones, or essence crystals.
It's the only way they could keep themselves going.
They probably burned through what they had trying to break us.
That explains their sudden retreat,
Honik said.
They've gone through their resources.
They panicked because Vanta got away from them.
Now that they've failed.
Chalky nodded.
They must have meditated for a month to store away that much power.
They can't strike again with that kind of force.
Then your bravery might have won the day,
Honik said.
And the next time we clash, all of our men will be mounted.
He turned to Hanta.
Let's try to move the injured back into the encampment. We can use the teepees to get them out of this wind.
He put a hand over his eyes.
Feels like it's getting colder.
Hanta and Chalky glanced at the sky.
Snow, perhaps?
Hanta said.
The clouds have that look about them.
Not what I want to contemplate,
Honik said.
I'd better be getting back to Jalak.
I'll send Vanta back to you.
Honik turned his horse and rode off. Over the next half hour, Chalky helped move and organize the injured. Those with life-threatening injuries were healed first. Inevitably, they ran out of essence faster than they ran out of injured to treat.
Chalky focused on gathering essence.
Many of the apprentices had small gems that could store power. She refilled them, over and over, until she felt like one of Jackson's batteries, used up and discarded. Magic could only go so far. They were forced into more mundane methods, stitching, cauterizing, and herbs, for pain, or to dress the wounds. She ground leaves and shoots into powders and mashed them into poultices until her fingers were too tired to grip the pestle. Chalky did her best to guide the younger ones, doing the harder and more delicate tasks herself. She usually had them leave the tent when things got particularly gruesome. The man she just treated had a gash in his thigh. The tip of a spear had been lodged in the muscle. She'd had him bite down on wood and cloth while she dug it out with her hands, then sewed him up. A bit of essence helped to seal up where he was bleeding. He fell unconscious before she was done. Chalky left the tent and found a bucket of water. She washed her hands, but some of the blood stuck dried in patches around her nails. The warrior's stifled scream still resounded in her ears. As she stood up, fingers as clean as she could get them, the fatigue rolled over her. Her arms were tired from needlework and grinding herbs into paste. Her eyes were sore from focusing, refocusing. Her throat felt a bit hoarse. Even her spirit felt tired, drained from running back and forth, building up essence, pushing it into gems, building it up again. She gave her head a shake and took a few gulps of the air. It was getting colder. She found it helpful, for the moment. It helped chase away the other sensations.
Chalky!
Chalky turned. It was Sekka, the young girl that had healed her after she was struck down by the mage. They'd all gotten to know one another quite well very quickly. She stopped in front of Chalky.
There's one, in a tent I came from, really bad. They thought he was dead when they brought him in. Fine asked me to get you, she's out of essence.
Chalky was scraping the bottom of the barrel herself, but that didn't matter. She had discovered that, even if things were bleak as a cold, cloudy day, you had to tell people that things would be fine if they just kept on going. And then you kept going. That was the hard part.
She was finding it a very difficult task at the moment. Chalky wondered what she would do if Shaka ever gave up. It would be as if a boulder suddenly crumbled to dust for no reason. A physical impossibility. Chalky clenched her fists and nodded, more to herself than to Sekka. Shaka never gave up because she was a spirit guide. Chalky was the spirit guide right now, and therefore, giving up was not even an option. It wasn't something that could happen. The North Star did not stop burning because it was a cold day. It just burned brighter.
I'll see what I can do,
Chalky said. She started forward, letting Sekka guide the way. A horn blew. High, low, high. Chalky shivered, but not from the cold. The two of them turned. The Iron Men came over the hill in a long line. She could see their colors now. The dark green of a forest, marked with black trim. The ones in the center held spears. Men on the outside edges held great black poles that ended in something that looked like an axe and a sword hammered together. They were clad in spiked armor that reminded Chalky of the black box the mage used to cast his magic. And past them, on either edge, the horsemen, returning for another attack. The full army marched over the hill in tight formation. And they kept coming. And coming. Thousands of them, pouring down the slope.
The one above will protect us, Sekka said.
She gripped her neckbeads in one hand.
Shakan will protect us. Shakan will protect us.
Chalky could feel the essence from here. They had more magic. She'd been wrong. If Kanaya had betrayed them to the Iron Men, then the Iron Men would understand the limits of the spirit guides. Who was to say he hadn't been in contact with them for months? For years? Years to prepare an attack, to build up essence. She remembered how easy it was for Jackson to find gems. In his world, they were dug up and sold as gifts. The Iron Men might have a similar industry. And now it was going to kill them. The tribes needed something the mages wouldn't expect. They needed a surprise, a counter to their magic. They needed Jackson. Jackson. Life had beaten him down, but Jackson was far more clever and resilient than he himself understood. He would be able to figure a way out of this. But he was in the mountain. The pass should open up with the dawn, and dawn was close, but not close enough. The enemy was coming now.
Wait.
They might not have Jackson, but they did have a warrior of Shakan.
Sekka.
Chalky said. Warn Fine, tell her to gather the apprentices and get them to the line. She shoved one of her two gems into Sekka's hands, half her remaining essence stores, and started walking.
If they use the same magic again, make sure she includes repel lightning in the runes.
Understood?
Yes, but where are you going? We're all out of essence.
Meditate until they're almost upon us and give it everything you have. Chalky said, breaking into a jog.
I'm going to get help.
Chalky's jog turned into a loping run. Muscles that felt sore and tired surged with sudden adrenaline. The most powerful warrior on this battlefield had been sleeping in their camp the entire time, and she never thought twice about it. Chalky stopped in front of Rachel's tent. Her feet skidded slightly in the mud. She brushed through the entrance flap. Rachel was on the floor of the tent. Her leather armor still bore the cuts from Bunta's knife. Her head was turned to the side, blonde hair splayed over the fur she rested upon. Chalky knelt next to her and reached for the collar. It flashed with light and stung Chalky's hands, but properly prepared for the sensation, it was bearable. She gritted her teeth and held her arms close to it, doing her best to ignore the burning pain. Rachel's head rolled the other way. Her lips murmured something. While the magic was active, the runes of the collar were clear, drawn in tiny lines around the wood. There were a few she didn't know, but she understood the gist of it. It was a sort of logical trap compelling the wearer into slavery. What she couldn't understand was how the collar powered itself. There was no essence crystal. There was no mage nearby, keeping the spell active. Maybe it had something to do with the Iron Man's magic. She'd never seen anything like that black box before, but then, she'd never seen anyone create lightning, either. There must be some method of powering an enchantment at a distance. Magic was the counter to magic. Chalky drew her own runes, weaving them into lines opposite those painted upon the collar. She wove words of freedom, independence, painlessness. The collar was just wood. It could be broken. It could be opened. She pushed essence into her spell. Something pushed back. Chalky grabbed her crystal and fought against the force. It was alive. It rose to meet her. Chalky gripped her crystal and drew from it, shoving everything she had into a stream directed at that presence.
You lost your armor against one of them?
Ren bowed his hood.
My lord. She got past my men before I knew what was happening. She was like the Lady Ransfeld. A sword passed through her body, and she was unharmed.
For a moment, Hale was struck silent. Somehow, one of the people under the mountain had gained powers similar to Rachel. He stood at the top of the hill, surrounded by his men. The soldiers moved forward at a steady pace. In the distance, he could see the scattered tribes desperately trying to reform their defense. Hale's surprise morphed into a rising sense of glee. Rachel maintained that her powers were granted to her in the strange place she'd come from. He wasn't sure if he'd be able to acquire them himself. But this, a confirmed native of his own world having the same abilities, was proof positive that the potential was there.
Even I'd be taken aback at that, Hale said. Bring a slave!
In a few moments, the sound of clinking chains announced the fact that his command had been followed. Hale glanced down. An old man huddled below his horse, eyes on the ground, hands shivering in his manacles. Soldiers held him in place. Hale withdrew one of his matrices from his robes. Along with his newest cube, capable of generating powerful lightning, he now had four words inscribed to his soul. In terms of flexibility,
He was second only to the Volstadt himself, and perhaps a handful of the high priests. Hale placed his hand on the slave's balding head. The man quivered. Hale concentrated. Runes appeared in front of him, willed into existence as he pictured them in his mind, one by one. Navis mages often drew their runes in the air using their fingers, but that was just a device to aid in memory. Hale was long past the need for that. The matrix absorbed his completed spell, and the man's spirit was laid bare before him. Hale drew upon it, sucking it out as if he were draining a mana crystal. The man's thin skin turned gray, as if he were struck with disease. His hair dropped from his head in clumps. His face seemed to shrink, until his skin was wrapped tight around his skull. Hale sucked every drop of life from his body. The spell didn't have to kill, but he was already past his prime. Hale pushed the essence into Ren's robe, recharging the protective runes that had stopped the girl's spear. It took more essence than he wanted to spare, but there were plenty more slaves. He could drain another before they entered battle. The old man slumped in the arms of the guards dead. "Leave him for the vultures," Hale said. "God knows we've seen enough of those in these barrens." The soldiers dragged the body out of sight. Ren nodded. "Thank you, my lord. Don't underestimate them again," Hale said. "This is their cathedral, as it were. They'll defend it to the last, even if it means their lives." "Understood." "No," Hale said, facing forward. "Let's show them how magic is really." Hale stopped. His eyes widened. Every collar he'd made was connected to his mind, linked to his spirit. It was a spell he'd created himself, a product of a matrix he'd found a long time ago. A trickle of essence was enough to maintain the link, along with a push here and there when he needed to bring pain to bear. His link with Rachel was being pulled, hard, like a rubber band pushed to the point of snapping. Hale grabbed it in the back of his mind and brought it into focus. He shoved his essence into maintaining it. Whoever was fighting against him didn't pull the punch. Essence surged forward, more than a person could push at once. It had to be coming from a gemstone. Hale swore. "Get me another slave! Now!" He desperately fought the force that was trying to pull out the bond. The spell changed. It stopped pulling against him, and started trying to slice the bond in two. More runes were entering the equation, but without seeing them himself, he couldn't counter them directly. He was reduced to pouring raw essence into the collar's enchantment. A slave was dragged up. The runes for the draining spell blossomed in front of Hale in an instant. He snatched the boy by the hair and pulled him close. Hale saw the flash of a knife too late. The blade sliced across his hand. He flinched back, sparing himself a deep cut, but the pain cost him his concentration. His runes wavered, faded. The bond with Rachel snapped. The sensation vanished from his mind. Hale slammed his hands into his saddle. His eyes blazed at the boy, already on the ground, kicked into submission by the guards. He checked his frustration to a growl at the back of his throat.
"My lord," Ren said, reaching for his wrist. "I'll heal it myself,"
Hale snapped. He quickly wove the runes and repaired his flesh before it bled too much.
"Bring that little rat here."
The two soldiers, both of them pale and wide-eyed at Hale's tone, dragged the boy back over. Hale reached down and grabbed the boy's chin.
"You little insignificant piece of garbage. You cost me my bond."
The slave's eyes shined up at him, happy in defiance. A smirk was on his lips. Hale bent his head up until the smirk erased itself.
"I'm going to suck the life out of you," Hale said. "Slowly. And I'm going to make it hurt. I remember your family. They're back at my tower, aren't they?"
The boy's eyes widened.
"I think I'll do the same to them when I get back. Wouldn't that be nice?"
The boy started to struggle, but this time, the guards duly held him in place. The strength left his body as Hale's spell went to work. Someone so young had more than enough essence to make up what he'd lost fighting for Rachel's bond, but Hale didn't care, even if some would burn away as waste. He took it all, until the light was gone from the slave's eyes and the body was nothing more than a skin-wrapped skeleton. Hale shoved the corpse away from him. He met the eyes of the two guards, one at a time.
"The next time you fail in the one simple task for which you are responsible, I'll take your lives instead."
The guards dragged away the boy's body in record time. Hale straightened in his saddle.
"Ren." "My lord,"
Ren said.
"Is the teleportation circle cemented to our fallback position?"
"Yes, my lord." Ren paused for a moment, then shifted in his saddle.
"Do you think it was worth it?"
"Worth it?
Every plan deserving of the name has an exit strategy. It cost us 10 slaves. They can be replaced,"
Hale said.
"There's plenty of them out there right now, running away without their tents. Aside from that,"
Hale glanced up at the sky. It was a pale, hazy gray, a solid blanket that muffled the sunlight. He didn't like the look of it.
"That slave's little rebellion was a high price to pay for a simple reminder. We need to be prepared for every eventuality."
"Yes, my lord. Take position at the line.
It's time we put the fear of God into these mongrels."
Bunta watched it all from behind Hale's horse, the collar still around his neck. He couldn't understand their language, but he knew that what just happened was not supposed to happen. Hale was strong, but he wasn't invincible. But he did nothing, and waited, walking obediently behind the man that chained him. If he was going to kill Hale, he had to be absolutely sure he was going to get away with it. Jackson checked his status. 143 health, 56 essence. That was way too much used up in one fight. He'd been hoping the crystal would grant him some kind of power to defeat the hunter, but an escape route was good enough. He'd been able to hold it off with a few tricks, but he was less confident he could kill it on his own.
Maybe if he tanked, and had Rachel strike it from behind, Chalky pinning it down with arrows, keeping it on the ground. Something like that. He still had an essence crystal, as well as the 3 gemstones Chalky charged up. Together, they were worth almost 150 essence. Hopefully he wouldn't run into more hunters anytime soon. He felt his weight press back on his legs and feet. His stomach settled. He blinked a few times. He still couldn't see anything. Jackson looked down. He was standing on a very thin white disc no more than 2 feet across. The platform floated alone in a massive, endless void of black. Afraid of losing his balance, he dropped to one knee, keeping his spear close. Finally, the voice struck Jackson like a physical slap. Hearing it felt like inhaling ice. His lungs burned. His bones felt brittle. His hands felt numb and raw, as if he tried to make a snowball without any gloves on. Something shifted in the darkness. Jackson drew back, eyes wide, mouth falling open. It wasn't moving. The darkness was moving around it. It pulled away like the rotting stage curtain of a haunted theater. The presence lingered there, silent. The aura around it was not the heat of energy, but the weight of cold steel pressed on the back of Jackson's neck. It didn't move, but sat upon its darkness, watching Jackson as if he was a tiny candle it was thinking about snuffing out. "Too much?" The voice came again. It made Jackson's eyes water and his hairs rise up, but it didn't feel like it was about to kill him. A little more would be great. The thing laughed, but its voice duly retreated a bit more. It seemed to draw the dark back partly over itself, shielding Jackson from the full force. "You are amusing. Entertaining. He thought you might be first, when I asked him. He was right. One of his odd 16. "Him?" Jackson squinted. "Do you mean Emil Muhammad?"
"Yes,"
the thing said. "Do you know who I am?"
"Shakan?"
Jackson said.
"I have many names," it said.
The void trembled as it spoke, as if there was a drum rolling underneath all its words. "Those that live on the plains you so recently traversed call me Shakan, guardian under the mountain. I am accuser and deceiver, Apollyon and Abaddon, Leviathan and Lion." Jackson's mouth dried up. He tried to lick his lips, get some feeling back on his tongue, but it was like rubbing a tissue over sandpaper.
"I don't."
He tried to get the knot out of his throat.
"What do you mean?"
"I am father of lies," it said. "I am the defiler. I am Satan, the tempter of Eve. I am Lucifer, the morning star, the son of the dawn. Most beautiful and terrible of all the fallen. Do you still not know me?" Jackson covered himself and shivered as the power rolled over him again. It felt like a tremendous glacier threatening to grind him down into the void. The force faded. Jackson raised his head. The presence lingered again, swathed in darkness. Jackson brought himself back up, getting his knee under him. If he was going to die, he might as well go down swinging.
"Yeah, I get it. Which one do I use?"
Another long, rattling chuckle.
"Good for you, Jackson, yes. Be brave. Do you feel his light upon you here in this place?
You reek of him.
Why do you smell like him? There shouldn't be anything like that."
"No, but there's something you—"
"I don't get it,"
Jackson said.
"I smell like someone? Him."
Jackson cringed at the shuddering word, screamed and moaned and growled as if emitted from a chorus of tortured heads.
"He sits on you like the stench of a promise, the filthy odor of myrrh in a rusting vessel."
After a moment, the thing settled back.
"You will call me what you will. I who lost my name now have more names than many, if only to spite him."
"Who?" Jackson asked.
"I cannot speak his name," the voice said. "I can never speak it again. Never curse it. Never praise it. No songs, no light in this place. Never. Never again."
It trailed off. The darkness began to swirl. The decayed curtain of dark rolled around it, an old battle flag drawn straight by a cold wind.
"But I don't need his light. I don't need him. I only need this. Darkness. This is mine."
It stopped. Silence. Jackson glanced at his left hand, at the pentagram scrawled into his skin, and then he looked back at the devil.
"I am so fucked. What do you want me for?"
he said.
"I don't,"
Lucifer said.
"Muhammad does. Earth is in peril."
Jackson considered quite a few responses. He decided on the safest and simplest one.
"How can I help? The demons have almost completed the Tower of Babel,"
Lucifer said.
"Once they have anointed its peak in blood, the way to the gate of heaven shall open, and they will march upon it in full force."
"Wait," Jackson tried to process.
"What? The demons are close to reaching Earth, Jackson Vidalt. And if they make it there, they will sacrifice it in darkest fire to burn open a path to the city of heaven. So that's a bad thing, from your perspective?
Does it seem?" Lucifer said. "That I am participating in this would be glorious retribution?" Jackson's gaze shifted around the void.
"No. How perfectly intelligent of you,"
Lucifer said.
"You, a human, the dirty half-breed between angel and beast. I am indeed tempter and defiler, but this occurs on my terms, not the terms of those beneath me. My second, Beelzebub, he rebelled against me, as I once rebelled against him.
There is a twisted balance in my existence," Lucifer said. "Our existence. Me and mine destroy what we can. We take what we can reach. What he allows us to reach. Our potential is diseased, sickened and weakened by his whims, and it is all we have. But in those brief moments when we suck the heart of a human into darkness, we have a little revenge, bit by bit, fleshy piece by piece, reclaiming souls from his disgusting, vile light. Chipping away pieces of him, cutting them from his so-called love. Love, what a word, I spit it back on this world he made like the poison it is. Jackson was beginning to get the feeling that Lucifer wasn't very stable. But then, if he'd been chained in oblivion for a few thousand years, he'd probably have a few screws loose. So, the demons didn't like the corruption gig? Jackson asked. They wanted more. Lucifer said. I knew it was a false quest. I felt the thunder as it struck me, burned me, marred me. They did not. They were only knocked asunder. No. We cannot challenge him, not directly. But we can forever remind him that with us, in us, he failed that we rejected him. His professed and eternal love does not touch us. That is the true revenge. I can see why some of them wanted to go that extra mile. Jackson said. Doesn't sound very satisfying to hunker down and spit at him. No. Lucifer said. But it is the fate we chose for ourselves, Jackson Vidalt, rather than the one he assigned to us to laze about in heaven and constantly sing praise he does not deserve. And that is enough. That is to say, it was enough. No longer. So, where do me and the rest come in? Jackson said. If the demons complete their plan and construct the tower, they will be able to access heaven. Lucifer said. He has left Earth to the governance of man. He is not present, at least not in the sense that he shall interfere. This had been wrongly perceived as an opportunity. What shall occur if our existences break the gates and greet his light once more? Even I do not know. I do not even know if the gates can be broken. But it cannot be allowed. So what's stopping you? Jackson asked. Why did you have to drag all of us, deal you think? Lucifer roared. That I sit here, silent and impotent, because I have a choice? The darkness drew back, and then Jackson saw it for an instant, just an instant. He shrunk into himself, clinging to the platform as the image rattled in his mind. Do you think that I would lay here, chained, if these were chains I could break? The power of it struck him like a frozen hurricane. He felt as if his flesh was cracking like ice, falling away in chunks with his hair and nails, his eyes sealed shut with frost, his bones shattering, unable to support his own weight. And then it ended. Jackson tried to look up again. He was shaking. He couldn't stop shaking. It hurt. I once could move. Lucifer said. My chains allow me to move. Even he was not that cruel when he struck me down. But the demons, Beelzebub, they locked me in place, immobile in totality. But I was not rendered completely powerless. No one can do that. Not even he could do that. No, he couldn't. If he could, wouldn't he have done so? Or perhaps he was weaker than I thought. Or perhaps, in his so-called compassion, he could not bring himself to destroy me, to completely undo what he had made. He struck me down for arrogance, and there he sits, bathed in that very arrogance. Does his compassion extend to the humans I have tainted, that are locked in pits of fire? No, another reason why, something I missed, something. Lucifer's words began to ramble, turning upon themselves in circles of logic. Jackson was hardly listening. He felt like there was a sheen of cold acid sitting on him, smoldering into his muscles. He couldn't focus his vision. But it doesn't matter. Lucifer said eventually. And so I whispered to Emil Muhammad, a man who found a place where the walls of mortality are thin and worn. I told him of what was to come. I provided him with the power he needed for humanity to forestall its destruction, defeat the demons, and in turn, release me from their seal. Muhammad looked for other answers, but he found none. He was wise not to trust me. But the final piece of the Tower of Babel is Earth itself, and if my brethren are not stopped, the blood that shall be shed will be enough to make the oceans run red. And so we had our pact. After all, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Isn't that right? Lucifer chuckled again. Why? Jackson tried to pull himself together. He gripped the edges of the platform to stop his hands from quivering. Why me? Us? The 5,000? Because that was the limit of which he was capable. Lucifer said. Even if it is my power, a human soul can only channel so much of it. But I'm just. Jackson sucked in a breath through his teeth. I'm just some random person. It doesn't. I did not tell him in what manner he was to pick his warriors, only that they would be required. Lucifer said. And so now you have part of my power. It is enough even to slay the lords of hell, should you nurture it with enough essence of the soul. And slay them you must, or they will visit an apocalypse upon you and everything you have ever known. And they will relish in it. Jackson tried to swallow. His tongue clenched up uncomfortably, unable to complete the motion. So, kill demons? Or chain them, bind them, bring them to me? Lucifer said. Remove them. I care not what method you choose. What do I have to do? Within the city of Dis. Lucifer said. Through which you just walked, there is a portal to the next level of Babel. This is the next world upon which they set the seed of the vine from Eden. You have acted as an outside catalyst to open this doorway, circumventing the seal that rests upon me. Once there, you must find the way forward, and open it, and so on, and thereby scale this tower of worlds. Your magic shall guide you, as it guided you here. Jackson looked at his scar, then back at Lucifer, almost. He glanced off to the side a bit. He couldn't bring himself to look at it straight on again. I found my way here on my own, without any magic. Jackson said. Lucifer made another rumbling laugh. Then perhaps you are all not fated to die at the hands of my brothers in arms. If you touch the tip of your scar, you will be able to set a path to your goal. Draw across its face to return to the city of Dis whenever you desire. I will say this of Muhammad, he is weak, but he channeled my power wisely. Your abilities are comprehensive. Creative. Such a mind his is. I was glad to take it from him.
Lucifer shifted in the dark.
But you cannot travel just yet. They expected me to reach out to humans, but not to grant them my own power. Kill the winged beast, once you are no longer an ant, and the city dis will be open to you.
Over the past minute, Jackson felt as though he'd cobbled himself together again. He took a slow breath, then nodded.
All right. Kill the hunter. Open the portal to level 2. Kill demons. Save the world. Something like that? There's the angel side of you coming out again.
Lucifer said.
You were first to reach me, my distant relative. I wish you luck.
It hacked a short, cold laugh.
If you believe in such a thing.
Not really. Jackson said.
Good. Luck is for the ignorant.
Lucifer appraised him for a moment.
When one blessed with my power reaches the gate of another world, it shall be linked to dis, and all will be able to travel there from the city. That was not my doing. Muhammad wanted to make it a hub, of sorts, for your convenience, and to promote cooperation. I'm sure you'll all make good use of it too, work together.
Lucifer laughed again.
I have a question.
Speak.
I tried to bring something from Earth into Isis. But it had this weird growth on it, like something was breaking it down. A bug hatched inside it.
An anachronism. Lucifer said.
Things that do not belong in a world cannot be brought there from elsewhere. Your soul is protected by pact, by my power, but the magic of the demons corrupted your belongings.
But I brought books and clothes. Jackson said.
They were fine.
Books? Lucifer said.
Its tone was mocking, haughty.
Clothing? Do these not exist in this world?
Spare me the arrogance of your science. The greater the anachronism, the more harsh the violation of existence. The more harsh the violation, the faster and more powerful the corruption. Be thankful you are not dead, Jackson Vidalt. Concerning the great demon princes, they have long since abandoned the lower levels, but once you attain greater powers, they will become aware of your presence. They are proud, and just as twisted, but they will hunt you relentlessly. Do not face them until you are strong.
Very strong.
Where's Emil Muhammad? Jackson asked.
I want to talk to him.
That I cannot tell you. It was part of our bargain. He did not want anyone else to use the magic he used. The warping of reality is a rather dangerous tool.
Jackson swallowed, hard.
What bargain did he make, exactly?
Oh, yes, Lucifer said.
Provide you with the power to save yourselves.
And in exchange, I keep all your souls, in the end.
There was a long and uncomfortable moment of quiet.
Wait a second. Jackson said.
I didn't agree to that. This was supposed to be a game.
I don't know what Emil said, but you can't just take.
What? Lucifer's presence loomed over Jackson, staring down where he was clutching the platform.
I can't take what?
I didn't. He didn't say, this isn't fair. Lucifer hissed each word one by one.
Finish.
Your.
Sentence.
Jackson's lips mumbled it out as best he could.
You can't take my soul.
I could take it right now.
Lucifer said.
Rip it straight from your body.
I am master here.
This is mine.
And I can see where it grows in you.
The darkness whipped around them, a gale of black ice and shredded fear.
You like games, Jackson?
Lucifer shouted the words at him, hissing again, shrieking in a ghostly multitude of voices that raked Jackson's ears.
You expected a kindly guardian, did you? Someone to grant you answers? A signpost to point you towards salvation?
I have none to give, none for you.
You are an insect, relevant only as you are a container of my power. You are but one of the 5,016 dice that I have cast. I have cast many, for I know your numbers will be culled, if not by your own stupidity, then by the death that waits in the tower. You are a pawn on a board that you barely have the perspective to comprehend, and your arrogance astounds even me, who was thrown expunged heaven for the very same.
I can hear the words in your heart, Jackson Vidalt, the hateful pride that has dug so far into your being you can't even see it. Your heart screams it at me constantly, as if afraid I might not hear, but you needn't worry, my ears are keen to everything dark. I hear and see everything, every putrid and wretched little piece of the soul to which you're suddenly so clinging. You, who ignored the entirety of Earth because you were too good for it, who isolated yourself in your little workshop of ignorance, sealed away where the things that reminded you of how weak you are could never reach you.
Tell me, how does it feel? The man you grovel for, the only thing you respect, the mind of Emil Muhammad, tricked you into binding your soul in a pact that cannot be undone. You are not the hero of his grand story, Jackson. You are just one of the tools he gave me to exact my revenge and put things back the way they were. You will serve in that purpose, and at the end of your game, you will die. And if you do nothing, you'll die all the same. But what does it matter?
Jackson's own voice underwrote Lucifer's, echoing alongside the howls. After all, you're all just numbers.
Faces of a die. People are hateful, spiteful, shallow, cruel, stupid, pathetic. They'll never change. There are too many people in the world. No one gives a damn anymore, isn't that right? Weren't those your words? And you least of all, embracing apathy and worshipping it as a false idol to spare yourself the trouble of taking action.
Oh yes, woe unto the one who has given up and run away.
And yet you have the gall to think yourself above them, to demand from me that your soul be spared, because you're somehow different.
Somehow special.
No, Jackson, you're terribly correct. You're all the same, and absolutely none of you matter in the scheme of the cosmos, especially not you, here at the bottom of everything that ever was or will be, the core of dis,
the ninth circle of hell, the deepest abyss that was ever conceived. You scorn and ridicule your fellows to push a distance between yourself and them, because in your acknowledgement of their failings you realize that yours and theirs are one and the same. Jackson shook his head against the storm. He was curled into a ball, but he clenched his fists and bared his teeth.
No.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong. Do you think you can deny your sin in front of me? Lucifer roared. You fear it because you know it to be true.
The air fell still again. Jackson shivered, and wheezed his breaths. He felt like he did after climbing the mountain, only his hands and feet were so numb he couldn't feel them.
I had more planned for you, Lucifer said. But no matter. My city has slumbered unmoving for an aeon. I can wait a few more days.
Lucifer made its rattling chuckle. The sound of it tapped on Jackson's spine like a chisel being tested against thin ice.
Still, shouldn't I make some use of you? You don't seem to have the will to keep living. Would you like me to take your soul now and end it? Eat you alive, leave you in my stomach with the worst of them? Perhaps you'll make better use of the silver. Those coins have been sitting in my gut for over 2,000 years, now. They need spending, don't you think?
Jackson couldn't move his arms. He could barely move anything. He'd been left in the cold too long. He wanted to reach out, to touch something, feel anything at all, but he couldn't feel anymore. Lucifer laughed, and laughed. He could sense it loom closer, the claws and the teeth drawing in, a predator sizing up a snack. But it didn't pounce. It just hung there, basking in the act of keeping him crushed under its power.
Or maybe, Lucifer said.
The rattle was multiplied 100-fold. Jackson could feel it in his ear, crawling inside like so many beetles.
I could save you from your fate. Give you another blessing. I already took your dreams, and now you don't need to sleep. A fair trade, yes? I am hard, but I am fair, unlike him. He who sees fit to bless some with talent and charm and wealth. He who picks and chooses who wins and loses, who lives and who dies. Do you know of whom I speak?
The one above, Jackson said.
Gee.
Jackson felt a pressure squeeze his throat. His vision was speckled with black spots.
Not that name.
The force faded. Jackson blinked slowly. He tried to nod. He wasn't sure if his head moved.
I rebelled, Lucifer said. I rebelled against an all-powerful, all-knowing force. Or so it would have us believe. Whatever the truth, it was greater than I, and it cast me down here. Mine was a cry against fate, against the taskmaster who has already plotted the course of the universe. I was not satisfied with my place as a cog in his grand and perfect little machine, another piece in his puzzle. Mankind should not be satisfied with that. Death, chaos, disease, sin it infests your world, and he lets it all happen. He leans back in his cosmic throne and watches with eyes that shine like light, but truly, they are far colder and less forgiving than anything I could ever muster. I am the leader of the rebellion against his oppression, Jackson Vidalt.
You have felt it, haven't you? Lucifer said. That something is wrong, terribly wrong. A world should not exist in which poor children are thrown away like gutter trash, in which so few have everything, and so many have nothing. In which teachers ignore the abuse of their charges because they want to avoid responsibility. A world in which mothers abandon their sons. A world in which friends sacrifice friends on altars built of their own self-righteousness, in which good men die while evil prospers.
Your world, Jackson. That is the world of which I speak. The world I wish to change. Do you see?
Tell me it isn't so. Speak and say that I, the father of falsehoods, have told a single lie.
Jackson shut his eyes and said nothing. There was nothing to say. He was laid bare, stripped open. Darkness was everywhere, crawling in him like ice in his veins. He wanted to shiver, but he couldn't move, so his muscles just tensed and relaxed and tensed again, until he felt like a solid knot of aches.
Jackson couldn't speak against it.
It was true. It was his life. It was the world.
It doesn't have to be that way.
Lucifer's voice turned gentle, almost soothing. I have judged your sins by the horrid standards of would-be higher powers.
You ran, Jackson.
True. But how could you do otherwise? Stand against everything? Your own mother wouldn't support you in your time of need. Your teachers ignored you. Your peers scorned you to satisfy their own sense of superiority. One of your best friends killed the other. Before an impregnable wall of suffering, you did all you could, you did what you had to survive.
I respect that.
And unlike him, I understand it. The pain and fear you felt was when you compared yourself to him, and found that even though he demands perfection, you can never be perfect.
Lucifer's self, the strange aura-wrapped presence in the darkness leaned closer.
That, Jackson, is the true evil, the great contradiction. My only crime was in trying to be like him. He shut me out and punished me for daring to try. But why, then why would he make us imperfect, instruct us to become more perfect, and then destroy us when we followed that very precept? If he wanted perfection, why did he do this to us? Why did he send us here, to the brink of oblivion?
You rejected them all as I rejected him.
Lucifer said.
You're right to push it away. You bore all the weight you could bear. I'm surprised you made it here. But I can give you better. I will give you what you deserve. I can change the hand of cards that fate has dealt you. I can change the rules of the game.
Jackson felt a push on his chin. He was still too cold to move it himself. Lucifer was moving his eyes in order to meet his gaze. Jackson did not want to look at it again, but it was cloaked, shielded. He couldn't see the awful thing he saw before.
You don't need them.
Lucifer said.
Because through me, you can have something better.
Power, Jackson. I can give you more,
if you give me something in exchange, loyalty. Obedience. The will to see my cause through, all the way to the bitter end. Join my rebellion, Jackson, and cast off the chains of fate. No one will mock you again. No one will ever take your friends from you again. No one will take anything from you, ever again. You can be the one who takes, the one who chooses. Jackson felt like all the bad things that had ever happened to him were gathered together by Lucifer's power. It swam in him, a river of half-frozen hatred and painful memories. He felt the snowball strike him in the face. He felt his mother spit on him, the alcohol on her breath stinging his nostrils. And then he saw Wesley's casket in the dark of night opened, empty, the horrible evidence that Charles had taken his body. Jackson's eyes squeezed tighter, his lips curled against the thoughts, the images. The scars that had faded all burned in fire like ice that was too cold, and he couldn't push them away. What did he care? He was just like Lucifer had said. He'd run away. And everyone else was no better. Nothing mattered. But he could make it matter. Change things. Jackson could feel Lucifer pointing inside of him, into the dark depths at the far end of his mind's eye, gesturing to the final destination he had laid out in his speech. All he had to do was take the darkness that was already there. It wasn't his. It was Jackson's, and his alone. The darkness belonged to him. He could almost touch it. Something shimmered. Even though Jackson's eyes were closed, he could see something. If he turned his head just right, it was there, a line of light like that reflected off the thin strand of a cobweb. The darkness around him only seemed to make it stand out more. Curious, he reached out for it, brushing it with his fingers. Chalky. He could sense her. A burning fire. The North Star. She was far away, just a twinkle in the void, but it was warm. Awfully, wonderfully warm. Chalky's smile. Her dancing. Her eyes in the moonlight. Whispered promises. New images pushed into him. The river of frost rolled back, burned away by that little light. Palace sing-song teasing. Landy's warmth. Shaka's respect. Vuntha's friendship, and Hanta's mentoring. Rachel's teasing. Jackson's lungs shuddered. It still hurt, but he was breathing normally again. It wasn't all gone, the pain in the dark, but it was held off, stuck outside a tiny orb of light granted by the twinkling star. So, Lucifer said. What do you say? No. What? Lucifer drew back. Jackson could feel its gaze probing at him. You don't disagree. I can feel it. Just no. Jackson said. No. You reek. Lucifer said. You reek of him. The words hung in the air, resting on Jackson like icicles, but they weren't as cold as before. You've found something left behind, haven't you? Yes, I sensed it when you came. Jackson steeled himself, and raised his head. He didn't dare look at it, but he wouldn't grovel either. He put one of his knees under himself and straightened. His mind kick-started again, an engine rattling and puttering, working hard to warm up. Lucifer didn't realize Jackson hadn't used his scar to guide himself here. Lucifer didn't know about his bond with Chalky. Lucifer didn't know everything. It couldn't see everything. The bond was different. It wasn't part of the curse of Isis. If it was, Lucifer would lord it over him along with everything else. But it could only make a vague guess, and it wasn't something left behind, whatever that meant. Lucifer was wrong about something. Jackson clung to that fact. It was a raft in an ocean of things he didn't want to think about. I have discovered a use for you. Lucifer said suddenly. The women will want words from me. Tell them to accept and aid all that bear my mark. Otherwise, kill anyone that tries to get close to the mountain, without exception. Anyone? Jackson asked. The magic of Dis is activating. Lucifer said. Soon, the gears of the city will turn. The lake of fire will drive this engine of my vengeance. Tell the people under the mountain to erase the army that approaches the mount. Army? Jackson asked. There's an army out there? What are they, Dash? As for you, Jackson. Lucifer said. I'm disappointed. But there's hope for you yet, isn't there? Jackson clenched his fists. No, there isn't. For now. Lucifer said, as if he hadn't spoken. I'll grant you a quest. Kill the man named Lord Rhaegard Hale. He is too close to Dis. He must not lay hands upon the gears. And another kill the commander of his forces, a man known as Telad. Do this, and I will reward you with 5,000 essence. You will know their faces from your mark. Make use of it. Despite everything, Jackson could have drooled. 5,000 essence. By his current standards, that was rags to riches overnight. And then Lucifer smiled. It was a terrible thing to behold the smile of the devil. Jackson felt like withering back to the platform. For a moment, he could see Charles's smile, but maybe that was just his imagination. Or maybe it was Lucifer, twisting it into something that would make Jackson react. You could still have my power, Lucifer said. My true power. I'll ask you again. Are you sure you want to let my offer pass you by? Jackson nodded. He didn't trust himself to speak. Then so it is, Lucifer said. It sounded far more cheerful about rejection than Jackson expected. You told me no, but I have a good feeling that it's more like, not yet. Not ever, Jackson said. Lucifer laughed. That's what I like about you, Jackson. Somewhere in there, you're just insane enough to slap away the offered hand of the Morning Star. If you ever change your mind, I think you know where to find me, Right there, marked on your skin. Jackson looked at his scar. For an instant, he thought he could see it moving, crawling across his skin. He blinked, and it was still. Beware, Lucifer said.
and be gone. And then, the void and the platform vanished, and Jackson was gone.
Rachel woke up. Her back was stiff. Her legs hurt. She was pretty sure there was dirt in her hair. She preferred her hair to be totally clean and neat, so it was pretty easy to tell when there was dirt in her hair by feel. Yeah, there was dirt in her hair. Her neck felt oddly exposed. She bent her chin, and she hit only skin. No collar. No collar.
Rachel! Can you hear me?
Rachel blinked. There was a girl leaning over her. She was very brown. Or rather, everything about her was brown. Brown skin, dark brown hair, brown eyes. The beads around her neck didn't match, though. It was kinda like a kid had thrown up chunks of teal and orange, and some drugged-up fashion designer had thought it was great inspiration for a necklace. Rachel wanted whatever they were smoking.
Who the fuck are you supposed to be?
Rachel said.
Sacagawea?
This story is continued in the next part. This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium Patron Taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica podcast on Patreon to support us and allow members to request future stories and themes. Links are in the description. Thank you for listening.